This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is It Was a Thing on TV.
Spoiler number one is Dr. Lee Franz. It stinks.
What is going on?
Episode 30, Submission 149. Hey Vince, what are we talking about this show?
This is the XFL!
The XFL aired from February to late April of 2001, and it aired on NBC, TNN, and UPN. So guys, when football season ends after the Super Bowl, yeah, we get so bummed because it's like we're not going to have any football for what, like, until
8 months, 7 months.
Even if you look at it from a bigger perspective, the draft generally doesn't happen till mid to late April. So at worst, you may have about a 2.5 month lag.
Yeah. So what do you do here? Well, sometimes in the past, we have some leagues that have operated in the spring. Now, originally, guys, we were going to do an episode on alternative football leagues. But because of certain events with our subject, we just had to give this subject its own episode.
Oh, and by the way, we are going to do an episode on AAF and USFL and World Football League and NFL.
UFL.
That's all coming down the road, yes. But we're going to focus just on the XFL today.
Yes. To get to the XFL, you got to know about two people. Vince McMahon and Dick Ebersol. And, well, Vince McMahon, we all know, he bought the WWF from his father in the early 80s. He broke the rules of the wrestling business. He took his Northeastern promotion into a national phenomenon with guys like Hulk Hogan and Randy Savage and Andre the Giant. And then you have Dick Ebersol, who got his start working for Rune Orlidge at ABC. And then he left to create Saturday Night Live with Lorne Michaels in 1975. And, of course, he would later go on to become the executive producer of Saturday Night Live in 1981 after Gene Dominion's disastrous season, replacing Lorne Michaels in 1980 to 81.
Yeah, that's another episode.
Yeah,
that's September. We were originally supposed to do that last week, but certain circumstances, understandably, had to push that back. But we'll get to that later. So, Vince and Dick, they met each other back in 1985. Both were impressed with their ability to put on a show. So the two of them would partner in the 80s to create Saturday Night's main event for the WWF on NBC, which would periodically replace SNL once every 2 months. It was a giant hit, and in the process, Dick Ebersol would help Vince with the WWF's television production, and in the process, improve the production. Because if you ever watched like a WWF broadcast from like a Madison Square Garden house show in like 1984 or early 85 or whatever, or just watch the first WrestleMania, it's like the camera work is kind of crappy. The television production is not that good. Dick Ebersol helped Vince like improve his television production, and just it just instantly made it a better show. And they were a great partnership together. But unfortunately, the partnership would come to an end when Dick had to leave Vince to become the president of NBC Sports back in 1989. How did these two men meet each other again, you might ask? Well,
how did these two men meet each other?
Well, I'm going to get to that. It had to do with the end of the NFL on NBC. Now, the NFL had been on NBC even going all the way back to the mid-60s when they had the rights to the American Football League. But in the 1990s, television rights for the NFL were becoming big dizzes. Fox had bought the NFC rights from CBS for around $3 to $4 billion in 1984. And in that process, it changed the game as far as money for televised sports. And in 1998, Dick decided it wouldn't be worth keeping the rights to the AFC because of the high cost. They wanted about $500 million per year to broadcast the NFL. So the AFC rights went to CBS as they went back to the football business, leaving NBC out of the football business for the first time since the mid-60s. Super Bowl 32 would be their final NFL broadcast for at least 6 years. Now, originally, guys, NBC tried to form a new football league with Time Warner. I actually just discovered this. Time Warner and NBC were trying to create a alternative league together back in 1999 to 2000. But for whatever reason, the plans didn't work out, so that never happened. So the creation of the league, in October of 1999 of the XFL, Vince decides to create the league figuring there was a drought in sports after the Super Bowl. So he figured, well, why not fill that with more football? So Vince and one of his longtime associates in the WWF, Basil DeVito, who was the president of the XFL, they wrote on a notepad a list of rules and what the vision for what the league wanted to be. Vince was a fan of aggression and smash mouth football, and he wanted the players in his league to have an attitude similar to the wrestlers in the WWF. So that the WWF announced that they would start the league 1 year from the date on February 3rd, 2001. And the following month, NBC announced that they would be airing the XFL. And not only that, guys, they would be 50-50 partners with the WWF. So when this all started, guys, what was your feelings about this?
Well, I was a fresh-faced kid in college, and I didn't know any better. I mean, this would just be my sort of first 5 years of being a very serious fan of football. You got to remember, Carolina, the Carolina Panthers were only in what, their 9th, 10th season?
In 2001, they would have been like their 7th season or 6th season.
My mistake. But I mean, I was young in my fandom, and I was eager to see what this new league had to offer.
I was reasonably optimistic. Football, that like you said earlier, sort of fills that void between the Super Bowl and, let's even say, training camp. I mean, the draft is only 3 days, and there really isn't much football between the draft and training camp, which is in July. So filling that void was exciting, but ultimately, the player level just it wasn't that good. I mean, there were NFL retreads and busts and good college players. I mean, some of the names, and Greg and I talked about this earlier, some of the names were you know, decent players in college, but just didn't make the transition to the NFL that well, or weren't prepared enough for the NFL. So I was optimistic about it, but not surprised about its demise.
Yeah. I should note, guys, what does the X in the XFL stand for?
Officially or unofficially?
Officially.
Nothing.
Correct! It stands for absolutely nothing. In fact, when the league was first organized in 1999, it was originally supposed to stand for the Extreme Football League. However, there was already a league in formation at the same time with that name, and so promoters wanted to make sure that the X did not stand for anything. The other Extreme Football League, which was organized in 1989, actually merged with the Arena Football League's minor league AF2 before ever playing a single game.
So the X in XFL is sort of like the S in Harry S. Truman.
Yup.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to get to the marketing. So NBC has a football league, a brand new football league starting in 2001. But NBC has a problem. They don't know how to promote this to advertisers. They have no rules. They have no players. They have no team names. So all they knew was this was a Smash Mouth League, but they weren't sure what it was, and they needed 6 weeks to show the advertisers what the XFL was. So they marketed it around two things. And what were those two things?
Probably the WWF connection.
Kind of. But they marketed it around the cheerleaders. That's right, folks. There were cheerleaders. And not just cheerleaders, but sexy cheerleaders. In fact, they encouraged the cheerleaders to date the players.
And that's a big no-no in other leagues.
Yeah. Yes. And not only that, they marketed around how sexy the cheerleaders were, and they wanted to show how gritty this league was. The XFL, the promos, they had these players avoiding cannonballs. They had them dodging minefields. They were carrying trucks. And what was the biggest thing that they wanted to promote out of this league? The fact that there was no fair catches. So they, to demonstrate it, they had a wrecking ball take a player out. Just to show, hey guys, this isn't going to be like the NFL. No, 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 no. We don't have any fair catches in this league.
Okay.
I'm still stuck on the cheerleaders because it brings back... Well, no, wait, Chico, you're laughing. You don't know why I'm stuck on this. It just brings back the whole jiggle factor thing that we've been talking about for seemingly like the last like 6 weeks. Yeah, okay, you know, what's one of the main draws of the XFL? Let's show the cheerleaders. Okay.
Well, it makes sense because at the time, the WWF, the Attitude Era, was more like swearing, like people getting pissed off, people beating the crap out of each other, and boobs.
Yep, that's about right. And this was before the Divas era of the WWE, too. So when you talk about boobs, you're basically talking about, you know, they're cheerleaders, they're escorts. The escorts to talent.
Yeah, and by the way, I should mention, they would also, during the game broadcast, they would have, like, segments on the cheerleaders. Like, this is what I do when on my work time. But when I'm done with this work time, I'm an XFL cheerleader for, I don't know, the LA Extreme or the Birmingham Bolts or whatever. There was this one segment I saw in one of the games where they have this woman for this cheerleader for the San Francisco Demons. I'm a teacher. I teach second grade students. I work to make sure that these children have a better tomorrow. But when I'm done teaching, I'm an XFL cheerleader. And the cheerleader bites an apple while Van Halen's Hot for Teacher is playing. I'm like, yeah, that's really great for the parents, huh? To have
It's not necessarily great for just the parents. The teacher herself, she's basically telling everybody she works with and her administration and the entire district, hey, look at me. Here's my side hustle. I'm a cheerleader.
In the XFL.
Especially in the XFL. I think if it was any other league, like the NBA or the NFL, maybe it might be a little more dignified. But since you're talking about the XFL, the bad boys, if you will, the new person on the block, I don't know how I'd take that if I was working with that teacher or associated with that teacher in any way.
And Mike would know since he is a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And also a cheerleader in my spare time.
So the XFL, it was marketed and sold as a thing that nobody had ever seen before. Now, there were eight teams in the league. They were limited to 38 players per team. And the XFL paid standardized player salaries. For example, quarterbacks earned $5,000 a week. All other players got $4,500 a week. But do you want to know how much the kickers got?
How much did the kickers get?
They got $3,500 a week.
That's not entirely fair.
So you're basically getting paid that much money to come in with 5 seconds left to go and kick a ball. I'm in the wrong field. I'm clearly in the wrong field.
Well, I was going to say, that's not necessarily fair because now the kickers here did do kickoffs, right?
Yes.
I really think that the kickers are the most important players in the game because they get to sort of decide where the ball's going to be placed.
But here's the thing. This is the XFL, and they didn't have a kickoff.
We'll get to that later. Yeah, the kickers only made $3,500, but here's the thing. If you won a game, guess what, guys? You got a bonus of $2,500.
That's not insignificant.
No, it actually is a good... That, I like that, because it gives the players more of an incentive to win and to play, because you're playing for an extra $2,500. So, if you're, like, not a quarterback and a kicker, and you're making $4,500 a week, you know, if I win the game, I'm making $7,000 for the week.
Right?
And also for a playoff game, it was $7,500 for a playoff win. So guys, approximately 3 weeks before the start of the XFL, to show the NFL that the XFL was serious, they were gonna fly a blimp over the Oakland Coliseum during an Oakland Raiders playoff game. But here's the problem. The blimp crashed into a seafood restaurant.
Ouch.
Yes.
What do you even say to that?
Yeah, I'm going
to... Well, what I was going to say is, I know they're trying to drum up publicity, but you sure as heck know that Roger Goodell or Paul Tagliabue, whoever was the commissioner at the time, I think it was Tagliabue, he certainly would not have let the cameras focus in on this rival league that's being formed.
Oh, no. Paul Tagliabue would be like, no, let's not even give him the time of day. No.
Oh, exactly. You focus your camera on that blimp, and, well, using Vince's phrase, you're fired.
You're fired. Okay, so now let's get into the teams and the coaches for the XFL. So As you know, guys, I took very serious notes. I took about 26 pages of notes. I was very prepared for this episode. So we have the Eastern Division. First, you have the Birmingham Blast. Oh, no, wait, I'm sorry. That's not the Birmingham Blast. It's the Birmingham Bolts. Yeah, so guys, originally the Birmingham team in the XFL was going to be called the Birmingham Blast. But you see, there's a problem with the name Birmingham Blast. Can you take a good reason why?
Probably about 6 years earlier, there was something that happened in Oklahoma City with their federal building.
Well, not only that, but there's also a history with Birmingham and church bombings back in the
60s. Yeah.
Oh, yes.
You don't want... That's no bueno.
No bueno. For sure.
Yeah. So, the Birmingham Bolts head coach, it was Jerry DiNardo, who you might actually recognize. He is currently in studio analyst for the Big Ten Network. He was the head coach at Vanderbilt and LSU, and after the league, he would go on to coach Indiana for 3 seasons. And a fun fact, Jerry DiNardo actually owns an Italian restaurant in Bloomington, Indiana. Guys, do you think our friend Chris Lambert has visited that restaurant?
Probably a few times.
Yeah, we have to ask Chris about that one day. Have you been to Jerry DiNardo's restaurant? So we have the Chicago Enforcers, and here's a name you might recognize, Mike, as their head coach, Ron Meyer.
Yes, I've heard of him.
Yeah, Ron Meyer notably was the coach at SMU when Eric Dickerson and Craig James were there. By the way, Craig James killed 5 hookers.
Oh God!
Oh no!
And of course, you all know about the SMU scandal with the play for players. But Ron Meyer did coach in the NFL. I believe he was probably the only of the 8 coaches to have at least main NFL experience. He was the head coach of New England from 82 to 84. And the Colts from 86 to 91. He was actually the head coach for the Las Vegas Posse in 1994 during the Canadian Football League's brief American expansion.
That makes sense.
Yes. So next we're going to go to the New York, New Jersey Hitmen. And actually, a notable name, their general manager, before we get to the head coach, was legendary Dallas Cowboys wide receiver Drew Pearson.
Hmm.
Yeah, Drew Pearson, of course, most notably remembered for that famous Roger Staubach Hail Mary against the Vikings back in 75 at Metropolitan Stadium.
I recall it.
Okay. So the head coach was Rusty Tillman. He played for the Redskins from 70 to 77. He was a member of the Super Bowl 17 that lost to Miami on special teams. He was a longtime coordinator with the Seahawks from 79 to 94 in various roles. He was the defensive coordinator for Tampa Bay for a year in 95, spent a season as a special teams coordinator in Oakland in 97, was the defensive coordinator for the Colts in Peyton Manning's first season in 98 under Jim Mora Sr., and later after the XFL ended, he served on Mike Tice's Minnesota Vikings staff on special teams from 2003 to 2005.
Okay.
He has experience, to say the least.
Yes. Next, we go to the Orlando Rage. Their head coach was Galen Hill. Galen Hill actually was the head coach at the University of Florida before Steve Spurrier from 1984 to 1989. Galen Hill coached in the World League of American Football / NFL Europe, another future installment, with the Orlando Thunder for a season in 1992. And then he coached with the Rhein Fire from 1995 to 2000. Hill coached in four World Balls, one with the Thunder and three with the Fire, and won two World Ball titles, and was named Coach of the Year in NFL Europe three different times in 1992, 1998, and 2000.
Wow. Storied career. So they're basically going football minds with wrestling guts.
Kind of. So now we go to the Western Division. We go to the Las Vegas Outlaws. Their head coach, Jim Kreiner, was a head coach in college for Boise State and Iowa State and spent two seasons in the aforementioned World League as an offensive line coach for the Sacramento Surge. And then when the World League became NFL Europe, he coached the Scottish Claymores from 1995 to 2000.
Okay.
Never heard of him.
I've heard of him. It used to be for a while, if you had the Madden game, they would include the World League / NFL Europe teams.
Yeah, you see that's during the era where I didn't really play video games from about 95 until pretty much about 2002 or so. So that explains it.
They had NFL Europe teams in the PS2, Xbox, Madden era.
I'm afraid to admit this. I don't know how to say this, but I had Madden 07 and don't remember that there. Because I think it has gone by that time.
Yeah, it was.
But also, the last Madden that I bought before 2007 was Madden 94. So I totally missed that era where...
You totally did.
Yeah, I missed that NFL Europe era in the Madden game. So that's why I didn't ring a bell.
Yeah, but that's another episode. Greg, continue.
So next, we have the Los Angeles Extreme. Their head coach, Al Luggenbill, was a head coach at San Diego State for five seasons and coached the Amsterdam Admirals from NFL Europe from 1995 to 2000. Now, guys, there was one notable player he coached, Al Luggenbill, in Amsterdam. Do you care to guess who that was? Because he was a big star at this time in 2000-2001.
It has to be Kurt Warner, I would guess.
Yes, he was. Kurt Warner played in NFL Europe with the Amsterdam Admirals in 1998, the year before he had that Cinderella run where he became the starting quarterback for the St. Louis Rams after Trent Green got injured and led the Rams to Super Bowl 34.
And the rest was history.
Yeah, yep. And an interesting note about Al Luggenbill, his son Tom Luggenbill, who is currently on ESPN, was a quarterback's coach for the LA Extreme. And guys,
guess who was the field analyst for today's? By the way, guys, in case you don't know, we're recording this the day the new XFL launched. Do you know who's the field analyst for ESPN's game today? Tom Luginbill.
It's gone full circle.
Yep.
Oh, yes. So next you get the Memphis Maniacs. Their head coach, Kippy Brown, was a wide receivers coach at Memphis State, Louisville, and Tennessee. He was the running backs coach here with the Jets from 1990 to 1992 under Bruce Coslett. He had a bunch of other stints as Tennessee as a wide receiver coach. He was actually the coach, running backs coach for the Miami Dolphins for 1997, and later won a Super Bowl as the wide receivers coach for the Seahawks under Pete Carroll in 2014. And a notable fact, in 1996, Brown helped running back Kareem Abdul-Jabbar become the first Dolphins running back to reach 1,000 yards in 18 years. And in 1997, Abdul-Jabbar tied a league 15 rushing touchdowns. Yeah, do you remember the football Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, guys?
Yeah, I was just going to say, it's not the Kareem Abdul-Jabbar that you know. Yeah, I remember him. He was a decent player.
Yeah. And a notable fact, the Maniacs director of player personnel was Steve Ortmeier, who was the architect of the Super Bowl XVIII champion Los Angeles Raiders. And last, we have the San Francisco Demons. Their head coach was Jim Skipper. He was the running backs coach for the Philadelphia/Baltimore Stars in the USFL from 83 to 85 under Jim Moore Sr. He went with Moore to the New Orleans Saints, where he was the running backs coach for 10 seasons from 86 to 95, and was the running backs coach for Arizona for a season in 96, and was the running backs coach for the Giants from 97 to 2000 under Jim Fossil. And by the way, Chico, a notable fact you'll love, he was the running backs coach for the Carolina Panthers in two different stints between 02 to 10 and 13 to 18, and was the running backs coach for your team's two Super Bowl appearances.
Yep, sure was.
And he helped make NFL history as two of his running backs, D'Angelo Williams and Jonathan Stewart, became the first set of teammates to ever rush for over 1,100 yards in the same year.
Awesome stuff.
Yeah. So the broadcasting, guys. So we mentioned NBC was a 50-50 partner with the WWF in this league. So they had two games on Saturday nights and primetime. They had an A game and a B game. So for the A games, at least in the first week, you had the following commentary team. You had Matt Vasgersian and Jesse the Body Ventura. Now, guys, you might be saying, well, wait a minute, isn't this 2001? Wasn't Jesse Ventura the governor of Minnesota at the time? Yes. But, guys, did you know that Jesse the Body Ventura for two seasons in the late 80s was a color commentator on radio for the Tampa Bay Bucks?
I did not know that.
Nor did I.
Yes. No. And, of course, Matt Vasgersian at the time, I think he was just like a play-by-play guy for the Brewers at this time, wasn't he? He was still in Milwaukee, right?
The Brewers or the Padres, I would assume.
Because yeah.
I'm pulling it up. Hold on.
Okay.
Well, he was with the Brewers from 97 to 2001, and then he went to the Padres in 2002. So this was right before the last season that Matt Vasgersian was doing play-by-play for the Brewers.
Yes, and of course, Matt Vasgersian will come up in future installments, Sports Geniuses, and another future installment, Baseball IQ. Those are not on the list.
They will be by the end of the night. How about that?
And in the B game, which was mainly just the regional telecast in whatever team's market was playing. Like, for example, the B game the first week was Orlando-Chicago. So it'd just be like the Orlando-Chicago markets. You had Jim Ross and Jerry the King Lawler on the B game. Now, Jim Ross, notably, it should be noted, actually did have NFL experience. He was, for one season, the Atlanta Falcons play-by-play man on, I believe, WSB in Atlanta before he went to the WWF. So he had a Saturday A game and B game in primetime on NBC. But for the weekend, you had a Sunday afternoon game on TNN and a Sunday evening game on UPN. Guys, what stations were the WWF broadcasting at the time?
UPN and TNN. And
yes, I think they had been, SmackDown was on UPN for at least a year and a half at that point, and TNN would have just gotten Monday Night Raw in probably about 2000 from USA Network in September. So, for the TNN broadcast, you had Craig Mervini as the play-by-play announcer, who actually worked in the WWF in the late 80s as Craig DeGeorge. In fact, Craig DeGeorge will turn up in future installments, Herb Abrams Universal Wrestling Federation, and future installment, Roller Hockey International on ESPN.
Oh, that's a deep cut.
Oh, well, yes.
We're only beginning with the deep cuts, I think.
But Mike, you're going to be very excited when I tell who the color guy was on the TNN broadcast. You ready?
Oh, lay it on me.
Bob Golic.
Wait, the Bob Golic from Saved by the Bell, the college years?
Yes, that Bob Golic.
I have no words.
Oh, boy.
But on the UPN broadcast, you have Chris Barlow, who was, I guess from my research, some kind of volleyball player turned announcer. But that's not the important part. The important part is who his cover guy was on the UPN broadcast. Are you ready for who his cover guy was?
Who was his color guy?
Brian Bosworth. Yes, folks. Brian Bosworth of your installment, Blue Mountain State.
Okay, there you go.
Mercy.
So, guys, that's not all. I have a fun fact I just discovered. Do you know who was a sideline reporter for the LA Extremes radio broadcast?
Who was the sideline reporter for the LA Extremes radio broadcast?
Super Dave Osborne.
Shut up.
Oh, that's great. I just hope he had Fuji on the sidelines with him.
Could you imagine Super Dave's giving, imagine Super Dave's giving his sideline report, and just randomly a player runs into him and he crashes into a wall and he turns into like a pancake.
Oh, that's great.
So when we think of the XFL's television presentation, we think of one notable thing that it gave us. The Skycam, or in this case, the XCam. Now in the ESPN 30 for 30 doc done by Dick Ebersol's son, Troy Ebersol, called This Was the XFL, the lead football director at NBC, John Gonzalez, explained the idea of the Skycam to Vince and Dick, and they weren't sure what it was about until Gonzalez showed them a Madden video game and explained to them, hey guys, this is what the kids are playing nowadays. If we want to get modern, if we want to do something that has never been seen in a football broadcast, we gotta use this kind of presentation because this is what the kids are into.
Makes sense.
Yep. And not only that, but they also had something called the Bubba Cam, which was a guy on the field, usually in the huddle while a play was going on, and usually taking shots of the action on the field while the play was going on. And Mike, we were talking about this before we started the episode, because I showed you one particular instance in a Week 2 game.
I recall it.
So there's a cameraman on the field, just being on the field.
Yes, and so in this particular instance in Week 2, someone who will not mention yet, but a running back on the Las Vegas team tries to go around the cameraman on the field, and it results in like a 15-yard loss.
Oh my God, really? This yes. is one of those cases of way too much, way too soon.
And a notable thing I want to note about the XFL, all the stadiums in this league were completely grass. There was no artificial turf. I don't think they had invented field turf yet, or I don't think it was really widespread at the time back in 2001. So every team in the XFL had grass on it. This was at the period where Giants Stadium, where the Hitmen played, used grass, because this was right after Jason Cienora of the Giants got injured in the 98 preseason, and then a year later, Vinny Testaverde broke his ankle in week one in the 99 season for the Jets. So in 2000, they went to grass, so that's why they were playing at Giants Stadium in 2001 for the Hitmen.
So they were all grass. So it was an all grass league. Field turf wasn't a thing yet.
Yeah, and this was another thing Vince wanted to do. This wasn't some pussy league where they play on an official turf. No, they play on grass. Damn it, because this is a gritty league. This was supposed
to be a callback to Smash Mouth football of old.
Yes, this was supposed to be like defenses. Is the best, and yeah, it's going to be rough and in your face and whatever. And what screams rough and in your face than what they did to start the game? Now, you might say, Greg, doesn't a football game usually start with a coin? No, folks. No. In the XFL, they had an opening scramble for the ball. So what it was... they would place the ball at midfield, and they would have two players run a 10-yard dash and try to gain possession of the football. And if the team got possession of the football, they had the right to either kick or receive.
They were making a big deal out of what was ultimately a glorified 10-yard dash with a dive for a football at the end. Now, it was really cool when I first saw it. Then it gets kind of, I don't know, old, you know?
Yeah. And by the way, I should mention, guys, the XFL's first injury resulted from the opening scramble. In week one, Orlando's free safety, Hashan Samis-Dean, suffered a separated shoulder prior to the Rage's 33-29 season opening win over Chicago. And he ended up missing the entire season.
Oof.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's not any good.
No, it is not.
But, not only that, but they had no point after touchdown kicks.
Boy, those kickers did have an easy job, didn't they?
I told you they had an easy job.
Yeah, they just had to kick field goals. So after every touchdown scored, no extra point after the kicks were done. Due to the XFL's perception that an extra point was a guaranteed point. So to earn a point after a touchdown, teams would run a down from the 2-yard line, similar to a 2-point conversion. And actually, this was not a new thing, because the World Football League actually experimented with this as the action point. And it was identical to a 1968 pressure point experiment by the NFL and American Football League, used only in preseason interleague games that year. So, guys, we talked about the whole thing about how there were, like, no fair catches in the XFL.
Right.
Yep. So I'll explain the punting rules for a second. The XFL imposed a number of restrictions on punting that are not present in most other league rules, the net effect of which made punts in the XFL operate under rules more akin to kickoffs. The purpose of these provisions was to keep play going after the ball was punted, encouraging the kicking team to make the ball playable and the receiving team to run it back. To this effect, punting out of bounds was a 10-yard penalty, outlawing the coffin corner punt commonplace at most levels of the game. Any punt that traveled at least 25 yards past the line of scrimmage could be recovered by the kicking team. Guys, remember that part when we get to the championship game.
I'm going to remember that part.
Yes. Thus, instead of letting the kicking team down the ball, as is common in other leagues, the receiving team was required to try and return the punt or else lose possession. Also, the kicking team was prohibited from coming within 5 yards of the punt returner before he gained possession of the ball. This rule, known as the halo rule in college football and common in the CFL, was dubbed the danger zone in the XFL. Coming within 5 yards or less of the danger zone was a 5-yard penalty, much in the same as the no-yards penalty in the CFL. Mm-hmm. Now, fair catches, of course, as we mentioned, were not recognized. So, basically, it's kind of misleading, no fair catch, because legally the player has to be within 5 yards of the receiver before he catches the ball.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's kind of a rip, guys.
Kind of, sort of, yeah.
Yep. So the play clock in the XFL used a 35-second play clock, which was a little up from the NFL's 40-second play clock in an effort to speed up the game. Now,
well, in comparison, XFL games are shorter than NFL games by on average. So, yeah.
Yep. So, now here's where we get to one of the notable parts about the XFL. The jersey nicknames.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
So the XFL would allow their players to wear a nickname on the back of their jersey. Vince thought that it would be a great idea, considering that most professional sports leagues would have the back, just the name, last name on the back of your jersey. But Vince was like, you know what? I want my players to show personality, damn it. So I want the players to have nicknames on the back of their jerseys. Although,
that goes into what Vince has said about the XFL. It's like, well, the NFL was the no fun league. The XFL is the extra fun league.
Well, the NFL is still the no fun league, if you ask me. But I mean, this is a clever idea, and it sort of carried on to Major League Baseball the last 3 seasons with their Players Weekend.
Yeah, because what's one of the best things about the Players Weekend? The wacky nicknames on the back of the jerseys.
Not just the wacky nicknames, but also basically every team is sort of wearing the same type of jersey, just different colors, but same font. But it gives them some personality, especially when you've got players in Major League Baseball nowadays. They have on the back of their names, instead of their nicknames, they have emojis.
Oh, yeah. Could you imagine if the original XFL lasted 20 years? We could have had, like, emojis on the back of the jerseys.
Mm-hmm. That wouldn't be too bad.
So now we finally get into the first week of the XFL. And there was one notable player with a nickname that would be something that is remembered to this day. In the National A game between the New York, New Jersey Hitmen and the Las Vegas Outlaws, there was one notable running back that had a nickname that everyone remembers. His name was Rod Smart, and the nickname was He Hate Me.
Everybody loved He Hate Me.
But, I mean, think about it. The name sells itself. He Hate Me. Why does He Hate Me? Who is He Hate Me?
What does He Hate Me?
What is, and the way Rod Smart responded is, He Hate Me. That guy Hate Me. Everybody Hate Me. Yeah, it just sold itself. And you had an instant star born right there.
And the thing is, America loved him. I mean, that was maybe not the best player, but by far that was probably the most popular player in the XFL.
Definitely the most personality. It's like, everybody loved He Hate Me.
Yes. But, of course, the first game you have massive ratings for week one. I think you had an 11.5 rating for NBC. But here's the thing, though. The first game, at least the A game between New York and New Jersey, was a boring game. I think the final score I have the final score right here. It was Las Vegas over New York, New Jersey, 19-0, and all 19 points were scored in the first half. In contrast, the regional game between Chicago and Orlando was actually an exciting game. The final score was Orlando 33-29, as I mentioned earlier. You had an exciting first game between Orlando, but the problem was that wasn't really the national game. That it really didn't give a good first impression of the XFL when you see one team in New York, New Jersey, who had a net passing yards of 144 yards.
Man, those are like Christian Hackenberg and the AAF type numbers.
Basically.
Yeah. In week two, you have a notable switch. Now, in the XFL documentary from 30 for 30, Matt Vasgersian talks about how, for whatever reason, Vince McMahon just was not a fan of the way Matt Vasgersian called the game. So he had Matt Vasgersian go to his limo and kind of like, Vince is like, pal, I got to replace you on the A game. I'm going to have Jim Ross replace you. You're just going to like go to the B game with Jerry Lawler for a bit until we can like figure out what to do. So yeah, you go there. And Matt Vasgersian basically remembers it as, yeah, I kind of felt like, yeah, I wasn't good enough for the XFL. If I'm being said, yeah, you're just going to go to like the television equivalent to Siberia doing the regional game.
That's tough because Matt Vasgersian is probably, I would say, one of the best, if not the best, play-by-play people, regardless of the sport.
Yes. And of course, Sunday Night Baseball and ESPN and everything. So now we get to week two. The A game, you have the Los Angeles Extreme against the Chicago Enforcers. Now, this was a notable game because, guys, this was at the period where LA, of course, did not have professional football this time. This would have been, what, 6 years after the Raiders and Rams left?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you have opening the crowd at the LA Coliseum to get the fans excited. Guys, do you want to take a guess?
Oh, I'd say somebody like Whitney Houston.
No, Britney Spears. No. If you want to get people excited about this new football league, you have to call on the most electrifying man in sports entertainment. Yeah, that's right. You turn to the Rock.
Boy. Well, he would have been a rising star in 2001, yeah. So yeah. That makes sense. Plus,
a year after the legendary halftime heat, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, 2 years after halftime heat with Mick Foley, that'll be a future entry down the line. But and also The Rock would have been in the Scorpion King at this time.
So yeah, that's what I said. He's a rising star because he was in the Mummy sequel, The Scorpion King.
Yeah.
Plus, also he obviously had a relationship with Vince in terms of being WWE property.
Yep. So okay, guys. L.A. Chicago, do you want to know what happened during the game?
Oh, something must have happened. What happened?
Oh, guys, you're not going to believe this. During the game, the power went out due to not because somebody at NBC forgot to put gas in the generator.
Whoops.
So, not only that, guys, but because of that, they had to, in the meantime, go to the B game. And Matt Vasgersian talks about, oh, geez, I had been told I wasn't good enough for the A game, and now here I am, back on national TV because the gas went out.
What do we say about karma?
It's a B.
It's a B.
Yeah. So because of that, and due to an injury on the field later in the game was running late, and here's the thing. These games were on Saturday night in primetime on NBC. Now, guys, what's on after primetime programming on NBC and
after the late local news? Saturday Night Live.
I'm sorry. I had It's Showtime at the Apollo on my card.
Oh, guys, no.
Oh, that's no. After Saturday Night Live. Okay.
Okay. So who would have been hosting Saturday Night Live this week in 2001? It was the recent Super Bowl halftime performer, Jennifer Lopez. Yes. Say, this would have been around the time I think she was still dating Puff Daddy at the time.
Yeah.
Or maybe, probably they were about to break. So, and I think this was also around the time he had those legal problems, if you remember.
Yep.
I think we all remember that. So, yeah. So, needless to say, this was a heavily hyped episode. But here's the thing, though. The game was tied after regulation. And they actually went to double overtime. And this is one thing I skipped because I wanted to talk about this. The overtime system was not really your traditional sudden death system. What it was kind of similar to the NCAA in college where a team would start at the 20-yard line and they would have at least four downs to try and score a point or whatever or kick a field goal. Well, now let's say, for example, like the first team is driving and you score on like two downs or whatever.
Yeah.
So the opponent would have to score in the same number of downs or less. Yeah. So let's just say on the first, on like the first play of the drive, a team scores a touchdown. The same team has to equal that in one down, or else the game's over.
Okay, that makes sense. You know what? Sort of like it is the literal definition of sudden death.
Yes.
Yeah, a very modified version of the college rules, which I love, especially over the NFL current overtime rules. I really like it.
Yes, so you have this exciting double overtime game with LA beating Chicago, and you have another instant star made from this game, and that would be the LA Extreme quarterback, Tommy Maddox. Who at the time, I believe, was largely considered like a cast-off from the NFL.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, he was the first round pick of the Broncos, I believe, in 1992, maybe 93. But yeah, he was supposed to be like the heir apparent to John Elway in Denver, and he wasn't. But yeah, this is a great way to revive his career because he did have a brief comeback to the NFL shortly thereafter. But yeah, more about that later, probably.
Yeah. So here's the thing. SNL runs late because of this exciting game. So basically, Warren warned Vincent Dick, like the duck, to Noel Edmonds on Cheap, don't do this again.
Oh, no. I'm sorry. I'm dead.
That's horrible. Sort of.
But here's the thing. I mentioned in the first week how the XFL ratings were phenomenal. Like it had an 11.5 rating. The XFL in week two got half the audience in week two. Still good, but not as great as the first week. But here's the problem. As the league went on, the ratings went down and down and down. And it didn't help that basically most people in the press basically ripped the league apart as low rent.
Well, I don't want to say it was necessarily low rent, but yeah, when you're playing with players that can't make an NFL roster or maybe are past their prime, that's not good.
Nope.
So one of the notable critics of the XFL was actually someone from within NBC. Someone notable at NBC Sports, but Dick Ebersol said, no, you don't really have to do this. And that was Bob Costas.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, you don't want to mess with Bob Costas at NBC Sports.
Yeah. Now, guys, do you remember when Bob Costas had a show on HBO?
Yeah, I remember it.
Yeah. So he had Vince on for about 30 minutes on his show talking about how horrible he thought the XFL was. And basically Vince was just like pissed at him, saying, "Oh, you don't know what you're talking about," and whatever, and just went up and got into his face and pointed a finger at him.
Yeah, I'm sort of surprised this didn't end the same way that Jim Rome and Jim Everett did.
Oh, boy.
Well, again, you're talking about Vince and wrestling. I wouldn't be surprised if he was going to get confrontational about it.
Well, the bottom line is, by the middle of the season, this thing was hemorrhaging.
It was hemorrhaging out of control. Yeah. It was hemorrhaging out of control, and it was a laughingstock of football leagues.
Yeah. And in fact, guys, as a desperate ploy for ratings, they advertised on 1 week that they were going to go into the cheerleaders' locker rooms. Yes, and do you know how this segment went?
How did this segment go, Craig?
Probably not very well, but
not at all well, is it?
No. In fact, it was a weird sequence where Vince was directing the cameraman. All right, you're gonna go into the locker room and you're gonna get the cheerleaders. Are you ready? Go! And then the cheerleader bumps his head, and then there's this weird dream sequence with the cheerleaders. And then for some reason, guys, I hope you're sitting down, okay? This segment ended with, for some reason, Rodney Dangerfield coming out of the locker room wearing a towel, talking about how he gets no respect.
What?
Yes! I'm not even kidding you!
Rodney must have been desperate in 2001. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah, Rodney Coyer must need the money at this time.
Apparently that Ladybug's money doesn't go far.
Not really, no.
No. So now, alright, so we talked about how the league was just hemorrhaging money, the ratings were going down, but still, this league had to go into a conclusion. So we have to go into the postseason. So, how did the postseason work, you ask? Well, you'd think, okay, 8 teams, 2 divisions, 4 teams. You'd have to think the first and second place team in each division would play each other, and then the winners would play in the championship game. No. For some reason, the top team in the East, in this case Orlando, would play the second top team in the West, San Francisco, and then the top team in the West played the second top team in the East, which was Chicago. Now, there was one difference in the postseason. Now, remember how I said you had a 1-point conversion at the 2?
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess to add, like, some interest in the postseason, knowing ratings were down or whatever, they changed the rule where you have the option to go for a 2-point conversion at the 5-yard line or a 3-point conversion at the 10. So, in the first semifinal game between Orlando and San Francisco, Orlando had a 16-point lead after the first quarter, but San Francisco would score 10 points in the second quarter to cut it 16-10. Then San Francisco scored 2 field goals in the third quarter to tie it, and then San Francisco got a field goal and an interception return for a touchdown. Yeah, Mike, I said it. It's an interception return for a touchdown. I didn't refer to it as the other title.
Good.
And an extra point in the fourth quarter to lead 26-16. So after San Francisco made it 26-16, Orlando got a late touchdown and got a 3-point conversion to cut the score to 1. But San Francisco would hold on to prevail on an upset 26-25 victory. And in the other semifinal game between the Extreme and the Enforcers, LA dominated Chicago, beating them 33-16 as LA's defense got 3 interceptions, and Tommy Maddox threw for 2 touchdowns. So, guys, you'd think that this would be an exciting final. It's 2 California teams battling for the championship. You've stuck by this league all year long. You think maybe that you're going to have an exciting championship game. Guess what, guys? This was profiled on SB Nation's ongoing YouTube series, The Worst. And guess what? There was only one season of the original XFL. So you're going to guess that this title game was not good. So you have a 3-0 game through the first quarter. LA gets a touchdown to make it 9-0. They miss an extra point. So here we have a situation here where it's 3rd and 31. Oh, yeah, I forgot to mention by this point, Matt Vasgersian after week 6 was back as the A announcer replacing Jim Ross. So, okay, so the clip I'm going to play here is the score is LA 9, San Francisco nothing. San Francisco is deep in their own territory at 3rd and 31. Now, guys, remember what I said about the punting, how if a ball travels 25 yards, it can be recovered by either team?
Yes.
Well, maybe. So San Francisco, to try to catch the extreme off guard, decided to punt with the quarterback at 3rd and 31. And, well, here's what happened.
Well, they got nobody back deep, Los Angeles. Not sure if Mike Pulaski has this in his repertoire. Well, he does now. 3rd and 31. Quick kick. There it is. Oh, free ball. A flag on the play. Jimmy the Jet got in between him, but it's Reggie Durden to pick up. It's Durden across midfield. You talk about a backfire. You talk about a plan gone bad. We'll see what the flag means, but if the play holds up, it's 16-0 LA.
I'll tell you what the flag means. San Francisco did not give the Los Angeles return man a fair chance to catch the football.
Violation of the 5-yard bell, kicking team number 4. That penalty is declined. The touchdown is good.
Oh, man.
Well, so much for my offensive coordinator moves.
So, yeah, as Matt said, this did not go well for San Francisco. I think 2 players collide into 1 player from LA, and then the number 21 in LA picks it up, and he just returns it his very way for the touchdown.
It's a good rule in theory.
Yeah, because, I mean, if a punt goes 25 yards, any team can recover it, regardless if the person touched it or not. And you want to try to catch them off guard. You want to get some offense going, San Francisco. But no, it did not go well for them at all. And the game just went downhill for San Francisco. They lost 38-6. As a matter of fact, San Francisco would bench their starting quarterback. And their backup quarterback got injured near the end of the game. And got replaced by their third-string quarterback, who recorded their only score for a touchdown with, like, 30 seconds left.
Ooh, not a good day at the office for San Francisco.
No. And with that, the LA Extreme were the 2001 XFL champions. And do you want to know who the MVP of the game was?
Who was the MVP of the game?
The kicker, Jose Cortez.
He earned his 30,000 that week.
Oh, by the way, we didn't even mention the championship game of the XFL was called the $1 million game because the teammates split a pot of $1 million. It was actually originally going to be called the big game at the end, but somewhere along the line, the XFL decided, no. I think the $1 million game is much better.
Well, also, the big game is generally referred to the Super Bowl because the NFL doesn't like people using the word Super Bowl, or at least media using it.
Yeah. Unless you're sponsoring or something, yeah.
Yeah. You know, being that it's the $1 million game and being with the WWF connection, I'm surprised Ted DiBiase didn't show up with a giant check. And then after the game, Virgil took everyone to the Olive Garden for some meat sauce and breadsticks.
But that would have been a great tie-in. Get Ted DiBiase to bring in the million. That would have been great.
And then do the evil laugh after he gives them the check.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, so, guys, the WWF and NBC lost a reported $35 million on the venture, only recuperating about 30% of their combined $100 million investment. Although paid attendance was respectable, if unimpressive, because overall attendance was only 10% below the league's goal had been at the start of the season, the XFL ceased operations after one season due to low TV ratings. Now, before they had to shut the league down, NBC said to Vince, you're not going to get a second season of the XFL. So Vince thought, okay, well, maybe I can try to continue it at UPN and TNN. So he asked UPN, hey, guys, would you be interested in a second season of the XFL? And UPN was like, sure, Vince, but on one condition. You're going to have to cut WWF SmackDown from 2 hours to 90 minutes.
Uh-oh.
And that's not good, because at the time, WWF had this big deal with Viacom where they essentially got all the ad money from their deal with Viacom, and losing 30 minutes of SmackDown meant they weren't going to get 30 minutes of that TV revenue of the ad money. So Vince was like, you know what? It's not worth it. Let's just shut it down. And so on May 10th, 2001, the XFL was done after one season.
Aww.
Well, the original XFL.
Yes, the original XFL, because as I mentioned, the XFL was profiled in Charlie Ebersole, the son of Dick Ebersole's documentary for 30 for 30. This was the XFL. And at the end of the documentary, Vin says to Dick, you know what, Dick, I've been thinking maybe it's time to bring the idea of the XFL back. And what do you know, later that year, Vince McMahon said in a press conference, guys, are you ready for this? I'm bringing the XFL back. And I remember when this was announced, like, in the end of 2017, I was like, what?
Yeah, but also, like, around the same time, you had the announcement that the AAF was coming.
Yeah.
So now you had two competitors to the NFL coming. And again, the AAF is a separate show for another day. But the one thing I got to give Vince and the XFL 2020 credit for, this definitely was not rushed. Vince took his time with the XFL, and you can see that he's making wiser decisions, because the commissioner of the XFL is Oliver Luck, who is a former player, also father of Andrew Luck, who played for the Colts. And also, he has experience, I believe he is a football coach. I think he was coach at Virginia. Let me take a look really fast.
I believe he was an AD, I believe.
So, yeah, he's the commissioner and CEO of the XFL, which is pretty lofty title right there.
President of NFL Europe, athletic director at West Virginia for 4-5 years, and the executive vice president at the NCAA before going to the XFL.
And he got his JD from University of Texas School of Law in 1987. So he's not just an athlete, he's a pretty smart guy too.
Yes. And I think Oliver Luck was the guy that instantly gave this league credibility, this new version of the XFL credibility, because Oliver Luck is coming from the NCAA. It's like, when you heard that announcement, it's like, okay, they have to be serious here, because Oliver Luck would not leave a cushy job at the NCAA if this league was going to be just one and done.
Absolutely.
Yep, they're definitely thinking long term, and I saw the reaction to the games that we had today, and it's been mostly positive.
Oh yes, it's been very good. I thoroughly enjoyed the first game. I didn't have a chance to see the second game, but this is definitely not the XFL of 19 years ago.
No. I mean, you have ESPN, you have Fox, you have ABC, you have FS1. So, unlike the AAF, which used, you know, CBS Sports Network, TNT, and had some of their games streaming on Bleacher Report's app, you have, like, serious networks involved in this.
And you've actually got pretty decent players this time. You've got some name players, maybe not superstar players, but at least when Greg and I were looking at the rosters about a week or two ago and comparing them to the first XFL's rosters, there are a lot more recognizable names.
Yeah, I mean, you got Cordell Jones on the DC Defenders.
Glenville in the house! Oh, sorry.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's where I teach. I'm sorry.
Yeah. You have Sammy. I was going to say, you have Sammy Coates, the former Steelers wide receiver on Houston.
And former Brown, but enough about that.
Yeah.
They have Elijah Hood at the on the Los Angeles Wildcats. Tar Heel in the house.
Oh, and by the way, there's another Tar Heel in the league, Chico.
This is
Ricky Prohl's son.
Austin.
Austin Prohl.
Austin Prohl.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I remember that guy.
Who scored the first touchdown in XFL 2020 history.
Yes.
Little trivia for later.
Yeah.
The first player to score a touchdown in XFL 2020 history came from what school? Duke, shut your mouth.
Oh. So yeah, I think we can say, listen, we don't know if the new XFL is going to be a success or not, but I gotta say, after the first day of games, we are loving what we saw so far. And the reaction online has been mostly positive.
Yep.
And the good thing about...
I'm sorry, the other thing I wanted to add... The head coaches that they got this time around, they didn't just get retreads from NFL Europe. They got some very good coaches, or at least coaches that have actually coached at the pro level, at the NFL level. June Jones, Jim Zorn, Kevin Gilbride, Mark Trestman. Each of those men has been a head coach at the NFL level. So they weren't like retreads from NFL Europe or arena football or whatnot. They got legitimately good coaches.
And not to mention, we didn't even mention that the defensive coordinator for Mark Trestman is Jerry Glanville.
Himself a former head coach. But also, that makes you wonder, Greg, did he leave two tickets at the will call window for Elvis?
Well, Mike, I hope. Well, I was going to say. Well, Mike, I hope in tomorrow's game between the Vipers and the Guardians at MetLife Stadium, some guy who does the will call at MetLife Stadium is looking at Jerry Glanville's request being like, Elvis, what the hell?
Yeah, they don't get it. Do a Google search on Jerry Glanville and Elvis, and you'll get the whole story.
So, guys, that's the XFL 2020, but the XFL 2001, you had opening scrambles, you had cheerleaders, you had no fair catches.
You had Rodney Dangerfield.
You had Rodney Dangerfield in a towel. You had Matt Baskerville and Jesse Ventura.
The King, JR, and Mike Adam Lee work at the same game, which was, let's be honest, strange.
By the way, guys, Mike Adam Lee in WWE, that's a future entry. And Chico, you didn't even mention that Jonathan Coachman was also involved in the 2001 XFL. Of course, the coach was already in WWF at this point. And, of course, the coach has gone on to bigger and better things at ESPN. And also, now is doing the pregame on YouTube for the new XFL. So, yeah, we have like... It's come full circle for the coach. You gotta love it. But Mike, good for him. But Mike, take us out, and then we'll get to what you said about, you know.
Yeah, it had all of that stuff, and then it didn't have ratings, and Mike. Yeah.
All that you mentioned, Greg, is great, but there's one thing that it was missing.
What was that, Mike?
People watching it. And that's why we fondly look back at the XFL as just another thing on TV.
Yeah, so the original XFL, the 2001 version, we closed the book on, but man, the 2020 version, if day one is any indication, man, I'm looking forward to what's to come.
It'll be the new USFL, and I say that only sort of jokingly, because the USFL did get a good 3 years or 4 years length out of it. Hopefully it'll last longer than that, but the changes that I saw today and the games I saw today were very fun, so hopefully that continues and doesn't go the route of the AAF.
You are...
Look what I have to go through. They told me to come clean. I tell you, when I play football, I got no respect at all. I shared a locker with a mutt. Yeah, I was a quarterback, and it was rough. I kept falling in love with the center. Hey, where's my wife? I can hear my wife. Where is she?
6 weeks later.
Well, guys.
Yeah, the XFL 2020 is on a temporary hiatus, hopefully, because, of course, as everybody knows, the coronavirus has impacted everything, especially over the last, 4 days.
They say they're going to come back again next season. All I can say is I've heard that one before.
Well, but I mean, it was a different game than what we saw back in 2001.
Yeah, it was a different game. It was a better game.
And it was a better game. Exactly. That's where I was going with that. As is usually like a theme on this show, I need closure. And I really need closure from the Washington, D.C. Defenders, or specifically their fans. I want them to build a beer snake that stretches across the length of the stadium.
Yeah. Although, to be honest, PFT Commenter has already declared the DC Defenders the 2020 XFL champion, so I'm going to go by PFT Commenter's word.
I would have probably made them the champs, too. The Washington, DC Defenders were the best team.
The best, because Houston was 5-0.
Yeah. And who knows, maybe the NFL will sort of kind of borrow some of the stuff from the XFL. I mean, they did take the 2-point conversion from the original XFL. Why don't we do the whole thing where nobody moves until the receiver gets the ball? I mean, that worked.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm just saying, come on, that worked.
Right, right.
All right, so we've said what we've said. Now back to the rest of the episode.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place Three Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceThreeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place Three Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation Pop Feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content, offering tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well, by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceMination.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth search projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceMination.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceMination.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Episode 31, submissions 890 and 891, CBS Daytime in late 1979, early 1980. Beat the Clock and Few.
Beat the Clock aired on CBS from September 17th of 1979 to February 1st of 1980.
Okay. That's the way. Every day you can play Beat the Clock. Now here's the star of the all-new Beat the Clock, Monty.
Chico, do you remember back, I think it was about episode 15 or so, we talked about the jiggle factor as it related to Flying High and other shows in the 70s?
Yes, I do. In fact, it was sort of like the genesis of Baywatch and other shows of that ilk in the 80s and 90s.
And some of them were successful, like Baywatch, like you mentioned, and Charlie's Angels. But others will be future installments on this show.
Ha, 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 ha.
And one of them happens to be Beat the Clock.
Really?
And, we'll get to that shortly. In case you don't know, this is for the people at home, Beat the Clock actually is a game show that goes back to the 40s, to radio. And once this amazing invention of television got really popular, it was a natural fit to bring Beat the Clock to TV because it's a very physical show. It's stunt-based, and you can maybe paint a good picture in your head, you know, listening to the radio, but actually seeing it and seeing the people, you know, make mistakes or get hit in the face with whipped cream or a pie or water or whatnot made it that much funnier.
Yeah, you don't have to tell me because Beat the Clock is after radio, there was one, two, three, four, five versions of Beat the Clock on television. There was like the 50s and 60s era. Then there was the Gene Wood hosted version, followed by the Monty Hall version from 1979, which I'm assuming this is the episode we're covering, CBS Daytime 79, because I wasn't here for the beginning. So sorry about that.
Yes, and we're covering the Monty Hall version, yes.
Okay, and then there's Gary Kroger's version in 2002, and Paul Costabile's version from a couple years back on Universal Kids.
And a little spoiler, the PAX version is an upcoming entry at some point.
And you know what? Until you just mentioned it, Chico, I had no idea Universal Kids existed.
Universal Kids has been around. It's been under different names. It's only been under the name Universal Kids for a number of years.
Okay.
But they've been around. They've been around. I've had them on my cable system for the 8 years or so I've been customers with this service.
Okay, it's the channel formerly known as PBS Kids Sprout.
There you go, yes. So as we said in the 50s version, you got the visual effect. You got to see the people getting hit in the face with whipped cream or seltzer water or whatever else. Very comedic. And I'm sorry.
I was going to say, Andy got Bud Collier.
Andy got Bud Collier, who was a very capable host. And the stakes were reasonably decent for that time. The gameplay was a little different as time went on. In the 50s, it was one couple played up to three stunts, actually two stunts, and then you had that word puzzle at the end where you had to rearrange the phrase. But it was a $100 stunt, $200 stunt, and then the jackpot stunt, which more or less got you – it was usually like a Sylvania or White Westinghouse or Westinghouse TV because, again, that was big in the day, and those were expensive.
Sponsorships, yes.
And sponsorships, yes. There's that corporate synergy again. But then when it came back in the 60s, 69 through 74, it was in New York for the first year, and then it went to Montreal, and at least comparatively speaking, the stakes were much, much, much lower. It was really done on a shoestring budget, where if you won a couple hundred dollars that day, you'd consider yourself lucky. And that's a couple hundred Canadian, so you know that means it was like 25 cents American.
Sorry to all our friends in Canada.
No, Password A is a different show.
Oh, God.
Hey, guys, what am I doing here?
Can we play Beat the Clock?
Oh, that's staying in.
Okay. So there's like five different versions of Beat the Clock. We're going over the 79 version.
The middle version of the five. Yes, the middle child.
Yes.
We'll save the other shows, the other versions for later shows. We'll focus right now just on the 79-80 version. And this was a huge takeaway from what you would have seen even 10 years earlier. First, as we said, we talked about the jiggle factor. Monty Hall had three assistants. And the three assistants, they wore the shortest possible shorts they could. So let's bring in the jiggle factor and make these show off these ladies as sexual devices, would you want to say?
Yes.
That might be the best way of phrasing it. And the whole format was different now. The whole format was contained within a show, like the 60s/70s version. But now you had like a preliminary toss-up stunt played by two teams, two couples, and whoever won that stunt won $500 and got the chance to play another stunt for another $500. And then you did this again. The two couples played a second sort of like preliminary stunt, you know, to figure out who will get the $500. And then, again, the winner of that second preliminary stunt would get to play for another $500. And then it got really weird because what determined the winner of the day? Shuffleboard.
Oh man, why didn't Ken and John mention that in their omnibus episode on shuffleboard?
Because they didn't care about watching this show.
Well, I don't blame them.
But, and for good reason. I mean, there's Monty Hall and Hot Pants.
Did you say Monty Hall and Hot Pants or Monty Hall in Hot Pants?
Yes.
Oh, jeez.
Well, that's an image I don't want to see.
So, yeah, the game was determined by shuffleboard. And it was like a regular shuffleboard table length. You know, probably, I'm guessing, about 10 feet in length or so. And there were sections blocked off. They had sections for $300, $400, $500, all the way up to $1,000 in $100 increments. And whichever team had the puck on the highest amount of money or further along the board without going over was the day's winner, regardless how much they had won previously.
So if you
had $2,000 from all the previous stunts, and you ended up losing to the other couple because they got $600 on the shuffleboard table, well, sucks to be you. Enjoy your $2,000. They're going to be back tomorrow as champions. Totally fair.
So the first two rounds are completely pointless.
The first two rounds are money-making, but they're completely pointless in terms of who's going to win the game today.
Well, at least they get their $2,000. But the person who wins the shuffleboard round goes on to, I guess it would be the bonus stunt or the jackpot stunt.
The bonus stunt, yes.
Yeah. Which is so incredibly important that it has its own sort of theming and staging. It has a corner of the stage. It has its own lights. It has its own sort of backdrop.
Oh, it had its own backdrop, and the thing is, it isn't necessarily blocked off to a certain quarter of the stage. There were some stunts that actually used the entirety of the stage.
Oh, really?
Yes, there was one that I remember pretty vividly was basically a giant game of putt-putt golf with a giant, and I'm not kidding, probably about a 10-foot high or 8-foot long putter. And you had to put essentially what would be like volleyballs into a or rubber balls into a hole down the stage. It had to go over a hump and then roll up an incline and into the hole in the on the green. Oh, I shouldn't say a green. It was like a wooden platform. and you had to get two balls in there. And believe it or not, this stunt was won immediately on the first two balls.
What?
I'm not joking you. So, and I'll hook you guys up with it in a few moments. But yeah, so this took this was the big ending for the day, and yeah, some of the stunts were ridiculously difficult. Some of them were, a number of them were hit the first time. And what you ended up winning, since we didn't mention it earlier, you won 10 times what you won in the bonus shuffle. So if you won $600 in the bonus shuffle, you're playing for $6,000. Pretty easy. So the max that somebody could win on a day is $13,000 by getting all four stunts, by getting $1,000 in the bonus shuffle, and then getting $10,000 in the bonus game. And I don't think that ever happened.
No, I don't think so either. At least but not in the episodes that are available on Amazon.
But also, we also need to remember that this show ran for essentially 3.5 months. So maybe 70 episodes. It's not a big sample size, you know, 65, 70 episodes total. Yeah, maybe somebody might have gotten close to the $13,000. Maybe got $12,000 or $12,500, but $13,000 is incredibly difficult.
Okay.
So there is actually one time on the bonus shuffle that technically there was no winner. And you say, how could there be no winner? It's whoever's furthest along. Well, it's the furthest who's on the board that's touching a dollar amount. And believe it or not, there was one time the puck was between $2 amounts and was touching no money. So guess what? They did a puck off.
Oh, my God. Right, but
what, yeah. The puck?
So each one of them, each team had one puck to see who got the highest dollar amount. And so, yeah, of all the things, you know, it wasn't really a tie. The person didn't land in a dollar amount, which that sounds sort of like faulty design by Goodson Todman, that, you know, a puck could fall square between two values and somebody technically wouldn't win. That's bad design right there.
So this bonus shuffle just seems like a bit of a rush design. Like, okay, we need a full 5 minutes. How do we do that? Shuffleboard! Okay.
The kids, Mark Goodson was trying to make, the kids love shuffleboard. We gotta work this into the game somehow.
I've not seen Jonathan or Marjorie play shuffleboard, thank you very much.
I didn't even know shuffleboard was a big thing back in the day. I mean, I know there's tables. I've seen them when I was, you know, getting my basement done a number of years ago. But, yeah, it's not like I have gone to a family's basement or a friend's house and there's the shuffleboard table. Let's go play some shuffleboard. Okay. We should also note that the couple that had the highest amount. Actually, Chico, you're saying that the money doesn't matter early on?
No, I might have said it, but then it was like, oh, yeah, you know what? I remember the team with the most money gets an extra puck in the puck off. I mean,
right.
The bonus shuffle.
Right, yeah. Whatever team had the most money got a third puck, while the team with less money had two. And if they tied, both teams got two pucks, and they decided before the game if there's a tie who'd go first and or who could choose to go first and have an advantage. The civilian version did not last all that long. We said that this premiered on September 17th of 1979.
Yes.
Not even 2 months later, starting on November 5th of 1979, it went to an all-celebrity format.
Oh, yeah, because that works wonders.
That does super things for a TV show, absolutely. There were several changes in this all-new, all-star Beat the Clock. The celebrities played in part for the audience. And I know you guys know Tattletales, where they play for the red section, the banana section, and the blue section. They sort of did the same here, except you had two sides. You had the red side and the green side. And What happened was any money that was won in the front game, the first four stunts, that went to the audience. The bonus shuffle, same thing. That money won in the bonus shuffle went to the audience. But then for the bonus stunt, if the bonus stunt was won, $1,000 went to the audience, and the remainder was split among the two winning celebrities' charities. So you could have made a nice amount of money. Oh, but there's also one catch.
What's that?
Stunts weren't worth $500. They're worth $250 now.
Oh.
Cost cutting. Uh-oh.
That's not good.
That's not good.
Yeah, so adding celebrities and cutting the budget. Yeah, this isn't going to end well. Also, another thing that we hadn't mentioned up to this point, and this is actually something we mentioned on show 20, which was about the millionaire knockoffs. We talked about 21 and it having live music. And we were talking about what was the last show to have live music, or at least last game show to have live music before 21 in 2000. I don't remember what we originally said, but I'm pretty sure the answer is this show, because this show did have live music.
Yeah, I believe this was the show we mentioned, yeah.
No, I don't think this is the show we mentioned.
I think it was Name That Tune with Jim Lang in 84, but obviously, as we
I'm talking that would be true music, but I'm talking about sound effects and theme music, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, I mean, I know Name That Tune obviously did the theme music, but we just mean from the overall production point of view, not necessarily the material for the show. So, yeah, this was, I believe, one of the last shows to do not just live theme music, but also they did sound effects for the stunts. And actually, right around the when the celebrity started, they added a lot of synthesizers, because, again, that would have been big in the 70s. So you had a lot of very weird sound effects, synthesizer types of reactions. You know, like if somebody screwed up, you'd have like a crashing sound or some weird sound indicating they got it wrong or missed it. But yeah, this was, I'm pretty sure, the last show where at least the theme music and especially the sound effects weren't done live on Name That Tune. The sound effects here, outside of the usual bell, ding, 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 were done, or at least that were accompanied by the live band. But there's some other stuff I really want to get off my chest.
Yes, yes!
Okay.
Hold on.
Before you begin, the opinions that you're about to hear belong to Mike Klaus and only Mike Klaus and do not affect the staff and management if it was a thing on TV.
Or
the Place to Be Nation.
I am the management of It Was a Thing on TV, so yeah, I'm speaking for the management, darn it.
But hey, Greg and I are staff, and leave the staff out of this. Thank you.
Yes, they're not involved in this in any way.
Mike,
thank you. I've got a little bone to pick, and this really has been irritating me for the better part of about 11 to 12 years now. Oh. So back in 2007 and 2008, and even into early 2009, Game Show Network showed reruns of Beat the Clock, generally like really late on Saturday nights. And so that means they'd show two shows a week, and This still just irritates me to this day. They pulled Beat the Clock from the schedule, and I'm not even joking. I think it was the Tuesday episode from the final week. I wanted closure. I haven't had closure in 11 or 12 years. There's no closure saying, oh, thank you for watching. Thank you. You know, we'll be back in the future, blah, blah, blah. We don't know how it ended, and the final show isn't on floating around there on the internet. You could have waited two more weeks, GSN. You could have showed that Wednesday, Thursday, Friday episode, those three episodes, and then you could have gotten rid of Beat the Clock. But now you've had us hanging. No, you've had me hanging for all these years. So I really, really need closure. Did Guy and Rolna Hovis actually win that week? Did they win a bonus stunt? Did Monty Hall thank the cast and crew and Jack Nars, who is the announcer and executive producer of the show? What happened? We need closure, GSN or Buzzer. Buzzer showed enough episodes. They've gotten into the celebrity run. Show the rest of the celebrity run. I demand closure. Oh, and who's Guy and Rolna Hovis?
Yeah, are they Larry Hovis's kids? What's up with that?
No, they're not Larry Hovis's kids. Good answer, though. They were regulars on the Lawrence Welk show. And we all know how popular the Lawrence Welk show was in 1980. He was just a happening dude with the kids back then.
Oh, yeah, he was a happener.
Yeah, just listen to the latest Mobituaries with Mo Rocca on Lawrence Welk, let me tell you.
Oh, yes, that's a good episode. I've actually heard that one. So, yeah, three episodes. Come on. Some of us have seen the entire series and just want to know how it ended. And that has been another Mike Klaus rant.
Hey Jeff Bezos. Hey, Jeff Bezos, put the rest of Beat the Clock on Prime so Mike can see the end of Beat the Clock.
Jeff Bezos' call. It would be Fremantle's, remember?
It would be Buzzer's call. Buzzer, I love you. I love that you're showing Match Game Hollywood Squares. Thank you for showing Bill Cullen on the show last night, but I'm calling you out. I want to see that
line. And by the way, thanks for putting Annie Wood on TV, too. We really appreciate that.
Very true about that. But I want you to air that last week of All-Star Beat the Clock. I need closure. Please.
No, I got a better idea. Why don't we have an animation of Bill Cullen riding a Segway?
Please! That was the alternate opening to Match Game Hollywood Squares. Oh, shit. I'm sorry.
No, that's not staying.
If you're still listening, God bless you. Anyway,
so that was Beat the Clock, 1979 to 1980. But we're not done yet, folks.
We are not done because you have a. Do you have a second rant loaded up for this, or is this?
I don't have a second rant for this. It would be nice to see more of this. And we've actually seen a little bit more of this recently.
Yes.
Our good friend Wink Martindale, yeah.
Yes, we're talking about the show that followed Beat the Clock on the CBS lineup in 1979 and early 1980.
After September 17th, 1979. The pronunciation... of which has been a source of contention, but if you were to ask the host, Tom Kennedy, the proper pronunciation is... And are you going to say that the brother of Jack Nars is wrong? Of course you're not.
But have you heard how Jack Nars used to say it? Because remember, at the end of Beat the Clock, they would say, stay tuned for next over most of these CBS stations. But Jack Nars did not always say that. Stay tuned for Woo next over most of these CBS stations.
No, that would be the gritty reboot starring Ric Flair.
Woo! That's right, folks. I'm hosting this game show with a gauntlet of villains for 25,000 hours. Woo!
And then he also at least once said, "Stay tuned for Who next over most of these CBS stations." So we have Woo and we have Who, and then we finally got Q. So
whatever the show is called, remember, it's like, I think the most times I've heard it referenced within the show itself was three times, because I believe, I think it was a November show or a December show where Tom Kennedy was referencing the addition of celebrities to...
another show that added celebrities?
Yeah, it was another show that added celebrities. It was supposed to be a 3-week thing, and it ended up going the entire run until 1980. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. So,
way ahead of ourselves. However you pronounce this show, it aired on CBS from April 23rd of 1979 until May 30th of 1980 for 247 episodes.
Before we start our game, just a reminder that starting next Monday, November 5th, and for 3 weeks afterwards, we're going to be playing a special celebrity version of... There will still be contestants, but this time, there'll be stars as well, and what's more, a whole new way of playing our game. So if you think it's exciting now, wait till you see it starting November 5th.
The game was overly complex, would you say? I mean, Richard Dawson on Family Feud once joked that, you know, that it would take 20 minutes or so for Tom Kennedy just to get through the rules of Few. It was complex in a way because...
It was complex, but it was very lateral. I mean...
It was complex, but...
It wasn't Monopoly complex.
We can agree on that. It was not Monopoly complex. You had two contestants, and for each round, one player charged while the other blocked. Now, the blocker, what they had to do... was they put up six blocks on this board. It was a 5x5 board, and then there's a top row, a sixth row on top of it with three blocks. So there's 28 total squares. Six blocks were placed on the board. The only limitations were you couldn't put more than three blocks on any one row, and you could not put more than one block on the sixth row. So you could do it however you want. Some people would hit them early by putting three blocks on row one, or they'd get them late, put three blocks on row five, and then smatter like two other blocks elsewhere around the board. And then everybody, I don't think I've ever seen an example where somebody did not put a block on that sixth row.
Mm-hmm.
So there's your defense play as the blocker. The charger had the easier job in terms of trying to, you know, navigate the board. They didn't have to do anything terribly difficult in terms of strategy. Actually, they did, if you want to think about it, because the board, each of the first five levels had dollar amounts, $10, $20, $30, $40, $50. And then the sixth row had $200, $350, and $500 blocks.
Right.
And the idea was just the charger had to get from level one all the way to level six within 60 seconds. And anytime they hit a block, it would be a 5-second penalty.
Five, four, three, two, one.
Same level. That's what actually happened. They would count down like that. And usually Tom Kennedy would have like, you know, a hand gesture, you know, counting down from on his hand, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. So that was the penalty if you hit a block. And if everything was going really bad, as long as you're on row five or less, you couldn't be on row six, you can call long shot at any time. And what happened there is you automatically went from whatever row you're on to the top row, to row six, to level six. However, the blocker got to put one more additional block up there. So now this really swings the pendulum in their favor, because instead of now one block out of three on that row, or most likely one block out of three, there's now most likely two blocks out of three. And there actually is some strategy here in terms of where to place the block, at least the long shot block. And there's also some strategies if you see the gameplay, especially in like the tiebreaker round. You know how your opponent plays the board. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if they tend to go towards the higher values, you may want to put blocks in the higher values. If you want to, if your opponent does more middle values, you may want to put blocks on the middle values or the lower values. Or, you know, what if your opponent hops all around? Very unpredictable. So you're sort of left to guessing where they might go. But also, you know, it's sort of predictive because if you see that your opponent's going for just the $50 clues, strategy says that as the blocker, they may go for $500 on that top row. But also at the same time, maybe there will be reverse psychology used and the charger will go for $200 because, huh, I've been going for all these high values and I'm going to go for the low one and I'm going to surprise you. It's an interesting game of psychology and strategy here. It really is. And we haven't even gotten to what the hell they're doing on this board.
Yeah. What the hell are they doing on this board? If I remember correctly, there was something about correcting bloopers. For example, the quarterback of the New England Patriots is Tom Tomorrow.
Man, what a question for this modern world.
I have no idea. I'll need to pass. So, yeah, so the idea was you had what's called a blooper. It's just a phrase or a statement, but there's one word or generally one word or phrase or section that's incorrect, and you had to correct that phrase or that section in order to advance to the next level.
And the example I just gave, the correct answer would be Brady.
Yeah. I don't think they necessarily murked you wrong if you said Tom Brady, but technically Brady would be the right answer because the Tom part is absolutely perfect. The underlined part would be tomorrow or terrific or whatever you said.
Tomorrow. I said tomorrow.
Okay. I'm surprised you didn't say Tom Terrific because isn't Tom Brady terrific?
No, but moving on.
You're absolutely right about that.
Yeah, and don't get me started.
Okay. So
you're going to go on a rant now.
No, if I was going to go on a rant, I'd talk about Alex Guerrero and his steroid supply.
But that's another episode. Anyway, so you're going up the board and you're correcting all of these bloopers, and the object is to get one on each of the six levels before the time runs out.
And like we said, a 5-second penalty if you hit a long shot. And you had to actually call long shots, again, if you're on any level from 1 to 5, and then you moved up to level 6, where they're a little harder, and you had to get these answers within, I believe, about 3 seconds. So you couldn't really think about it. If not, you got buzzed. You had to pick another block on the same level. Or if you had used all the blocks in that level, you automatically moved up to the next level. And that did happen on one of the shows that's out there, where somebody, let's say, used all the clues on level 3 and didn't get any right or got blocked out, they moved up to level 4 and then got to play from there. But if you have time to do that, you're calling a long shot because that takes a lot of time off the clock.
Mm-hmm. But the downside of calling the long shot is that extra block in addition to any block that may or may not be up on level 6 already.
Right. So, yeah, so that's why I said that really severely swings the pendulum in the favor of the charger to the blocker. Since now there's a 2 in 3 chance there, the charger's going to hit a block. That's not really the part of the show that people remember, though. That was sort of like the appetizer to the main course. The main course was the Gauntlet of Villains.
Oh.
If you're a viewer between probably 45 and maybe 55 or even older, you would remember this from your childhood. This is something that you don't forget.
Yeah, this is another thing that needs that is laterally complicated.
It's complicated in a Jay Wolpert way. Let's say that, and we'll get to why it's complicated. Not necessarily complicated, but there's too many things being thrown at you once, which may sort of muddy the waters a little bit. So there's 10 wooden, like caricatures of different enemies, let's say. I don't want to say enemies through history. I mean, they're definitely resembling enemies in history or not like people in history, but obviously some names might have been changed. So the idea was you had to get 10 bloopers correct within a certain amount of time, which we'll decode in a little bit. And if you did that, you won $25,000. You retired off the show. And really, it's one of the great celebration, not just in terms of celebration music, but also in terms of visual. The visual aspect for 1979 was amazing. So there were 10 villains, and here they are from 1 to 10. So you had Alphonse the Gangster, and spoiler, he looked like Al Capone. Oh, and it's called Alphonse. So,
Now you get it.
Now you see, there we go. We can't call him Al, or we can't call him Al Capone, but we can call him Alphonse and get away with it. Wink, wink. And then second, you had Bruno the Headsman, who was he had a hood on.
He was an executioner. Yeah, I know how to speak.
He was executioner. Good elocution and executioner.
Say that I almost said executor.
Yeah. He was handling somebody's will. Yeah, he was an executioner. And he had, a hood on. And he had a basket with somebody's head in there. Not just like the top of his head, just his eyes. And they were sort of like, you know, glazed over kind of look. Then number three was Mr. Van Louse, the landlord. The evil landlord who, you know, he's got the deed and he's going to repossess the home. You know, from, you know, back in the Three Stooges days. Yeah, uh-huh. You need to get $500 before the month or I'm going to own the orphanage. Number four was, you can't really hide this name. And it's not like he's going to sue you. Nero the Fiddler. And he looked like Nero, and he's fiddling away, and there's wooden flames in the background, burning Rome while he's fiddling away. Number five was Count Nibbleneck the Vampire, who, looked like Dracula. Again, can't really use his name. That's copyrighted. And then number six, again, swerving around complications regarding trademarks and copyright, Frank and his little friend Stein.
Frankenstein's monster.
Dr. Frankenstein and his monster, but he was called Frank and his little friend Stein.
Oh.
Number seven was Kid Rotten the Gunslinger, who was just a cowboy. Number eight, Jeremy Swash the Pirate, with the eye patch and the scabbard, the sword or whatnot, he looked like your typical pirate. Number nine was Dr. Derange the Mad Scientist, and then finally you had Lucretia the Witch. Get through those 10 folks in a certain amount of time, and you win $25,000. But you say, wait, how much time?
How much time, Mike?
How much time?
It's like this wasn't scripted.
We didn't rehearse this at all. I don't know what you're, hold on, talking about.
Oh, I see what you did there. Okay. I don't know what you, line, mean. So you had 60 seconds as your base time, but then for every $100 you earned, you got an additional second. So if in the main game you got $880, you received 8 seconds on top of the 60 seconds, so you had 68 seconds.
Okay.
So the thing is, if you played if you didn't go for the big money, you might get, say, 3 seconds, 4 seconds, 5 seconds. But if you were very aggressive, you might have gotten 10 seconds, 11 seconds, 12 seconds. Plus also, a lot of it depends on the luck. Plus also, even another factor is if the game goes three rounds. Because three rounds means more money for both players, most likely. Because, if you're the If you're the blocker, you get money for each block that's hit, including the on the top line. And if you're a charger, you get more money for each block that you earn. So, yeah, if you played three rounds, you could get like easily a good 10 or 11 seconds on top of that. Few is actually sort of important in the history of game shows because it was the game show that moved Price is Right into its current 11 to noon time slot.
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah. Before then, Price is Right was airing from 10:30 to 11:30.
Yeah, right out of All in the Family.
Right. And also, don't forget that Few kind of sort of replaced Match Game on the schedule. Now, Match Game 79 at the time was on in the afternoon, but Match Game 79 was off the schedule and was replaced on it by Few, albeit in a different time slot. So there is a little bit of history here, because otherwise we might be seeing Price is Right from 10:30 to 11:30 now, and Let's Make a Deal. Who knows what would happen with that?
Yeah.
But that's all just, you know, pie in the sky. That's all fun conjecture. We love Few for a couple of reasons. First, Randy Emejia, I think it needs to be said, because he was probably one of the most influential people on the internet in the game show community the first couple of years that the internet got big.
Yeah, the first decade of the internet, Randy Emejia was basically the voice of game show internet. Now, this was before the advent of social media and whatever and what have you.
Yeah, but this was in news groups, and he was sort of polarizing. Either you liked him or you didn't like him, but the thing is, if you didn't like him, it's because you're probably a fool. And that's with all due respect. Because he really didn't take ignorance or foolishness too kindly. But the thing is, he was so generous in terms of giving information to the game show community, giving inside information, because you need to remember that he did work in some capacity on the Jim Perry version of Card Sharks in the late 70s and early 80s. He had also been on a number of pilots. He was also on Jeopardy. He won big on Jeopardy. But also, he just attended many tapings. And that includes, I think one of his first ones was he saw Now You See It as a 16-year-old. And actually, you can see him in the audience after somebody wins the big money. And so it's like, oh, there's like 16-year-old Randy Emejia. How adorable is he? And but also, he just, I mean, his life, his pastime was game shows. He would talk about going to different tapings. One of the last tapings he saw, I can vouch for this, was me and him and Jason Hernandez, good friend of the show, and also Justin Lally. We went to go see the Jeopardy College Championship, which was at UCLA that year in 2001. And I think that was about 2 months before he passed, and I think that was his final taping. And I think the final show to air before he passed away because the Jeopardy College Tournament would have been, I believe, Thanksgiving. Well, one of the last shows I know that he saw that aired was the pilot to You Don't Know Jack. Oh, future entry, You Don't Know Jack.
Yeah.
But, I mean, he went to all these shows and had inside information, made many good friends. I mean, he was a definite known commodity in the industry. He actually was on Few in August of 1979.
Yes.
And he won $26,190. And as he used to say, as he told it, he had the first episode. The first episode has been highly recycled throughout the game show community for 25 years now, but the second episode eluded him quite a bit. And get your tissues ready, because this really is a sad little story. Oh. So a number of people went to extreme lengths to find his second episode, and we actually did find it. It's out there. It's online, I'm sure. Randy Emejia unfortunately passed on December 12th of 2001, and I'm not even joking. We found the tape. We had a courier send it to his house, to his mother's house. And unfortunately, it got there, I want to say, like 2 hours after he passed. He didn't get a chance to see his second episode. And that, I mean, that's just heartbreaking. Yeah, he worked so hard for years to get that second episode, and he had it, or almost had it, within literally a matter of hours. And, but to put a humorous twist on it, just so, you know, we don't get all sad and stuff. Randy used to say that he had a coworker who was supposed to tape both episodes, and the coworker taped the first episode, but didn't tape the second episode. By no coincidence, possibly, that coworker didn't work with Randy much longer. Boy, karma's a bee, isn't it? But also one other incident which people remember from the show. I know a couple people I've talked to remember this. There was a contestant, and don't write me letters. This is the name he had on his name tag. His contestant name was Blackie.
What?
Blackie.
Blackie?
And again, not to stereotype, guess what race he was? Hint, not Chinese. So Blackie, he won the main game, and in his excitement, he broke his ankle. So they couldn't run the gauntlet with him then, because obviously he's probably in an emergency room, you know, getting his ankle worked on. But he came back with Pomp and Circumstance playing in the background, and ran the gauntlet, and guess what? The new ankle must have been lucky. He won $25,000.
Oh, that's wow. Amazing.
And this is not out on the internet, so this is just through word of mouth, but I've heard multiple people talk about him. So this obviously occurred. This wasn't some sort of fever dream or anything.
So this was a thing on TV.
This definitely was a thing on TV. Absolutely.
Okay.
And yeah, we tend to make fun of some shows here, but I'm sorry. These are two beloved shows to me.
Beat the Clock is a beloved show to you?
Beat the Clock I remember seeing as a little kid. And again, we're talking now 40-plus years ago. And I even remember when my sister was born, I was in the hospital, and guess what was on TV?
Beat the Clock.
And the Price is Right.
Aww.
And I remember that like it was just yesterday, even though it was well over 40 years ago. And I even remember what I was eating that day because I haven't eaten it since. Apple Jacks.
Oh, don't you dare knock Apple Jacks, Mike.
I'm not knocking Apple Jacks. I just said I haven't eaten them again. Okay. You know, I remember what I ate on September 12th of 1979, but I don't know where my car keys are.
Yeah, hey, you know what? That can happen to anybody.
Hey, guys, before we sign up, we forgot to mention what happened to you at the end of the run.
What happened to at the end of the run? Well, aren't you going to tell me?
Greg forgot.
You forgot about the celebrity run of
you. Yeah, because in November of 1979, it was supposed to be a thing for 3 weeks. But it ended up being a permanent thing that celebrities were teamed up with the contestants to play the game. Now, and ultimately that didn't help matters because I'm looking at the schedule. You know what was going up against in 1980? What would ultimately be the final season of the Hollywood Squares. By the way,
more about that in June, though.
That's another episode.
Yep.
But and the game was changed a little bit because if one team won both games in a row, the winning team would actually play the house. There would be a prearranged Don't know if it was necessarily random arrangement of blocks on the board, and they got a chance to earn more time and more money by playing that board. In the Gauntlet of Villains, one person, whether it's the celebrity or the civilian, played the first five villains in the gauntlet, and the second person, the other person, took the second half, the second five. Rules were still the same: 60 seconds plus a second for each $100, $25,000 if won, immediate retirement if won, for the contestant, not the celebrity, obviously. But just like Beat the Clock, just like Hot Potato, you know, adding celebrities and the name celebrity to your game doesn't necessarily make it a better game.
No, it doesn't.
And usually it's the death knell.
Yes, it is.
And who was on the final week of Celebrity Pew, you might ask?
Who was on the final week of Celebrity Pew?
Betty White and John Saxon. And to call back to episode 23, John Saxon, who of course many of you won't know from A Nightmare on Elm Street, Hezzy Card, and Donruss Americana, and guess who just bought a signed material card of his from that set for $2.99 on eBay last month?
You!
Well, it wasn't me.
Well, yes, it, of course it was me, because I hate money.
No, it's I Love Money, and that's another entry on the list.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's another entry talking about trading cards and TV shows, but yeah, that's another day.
Yep, so...
CBS oh, but wait, we forgot one more important thing.
What's that?
Who did the theme music?
Oh, yeah, it's me, Alan Thicke. How you guys doing?
Oh, shut up, Chico. It's me, Alan Thicke. I did the theme music.
Jeez.
Of course, this would be before. This is basically Alan Thicke, known as a composer and not so much a bumbling father figure,
or talk show host,
or you know, Jason Seaver or anything like that. Yes, this is a good half decade before. At least he got into the sitcom business, but even still, probably about 3 or 4 years before he got into the talk show business.
Yeah, this was and to be sure, before he got up with Gloria Loring and created 1/4 of the panel on The Masked Singer.
I was wondering how you're going to phrase that.
I was wondering how Chico was going to work Robin in.
Well, yeah. Now you know. Bing! Anyway,
plus, and I'm going to add even one more thing.
What's
the
that?
The opening sequence to Few. Do you know who did that?
Hanna-Barbera.
I totally forgot about this.
Hanna-Barbera.
That was Hanna-Barbera, yeah. Yeah, the opening to Few, the animation, was actually done by Hanna-Barbera, which is kind of cool.
That's kind of amazing that Hanna-Barbera did the opening animation for the show created by one of the future writers of Pirates of the Caribbean.
He's a jack of all trades.
What
yes.
Well, I know what you could say. CBS Game Shows Not Named, Price is Right in 1979. You either loved them or you hate them. But whether you loved them or hate them, they were things on TV.
Well, everyone, we got nothing to do for a little while, so let's check out what's going on the Place to Be Nation right now. In the latest episode of the Brother Sister We Watch podcast, Kevin and Mary looked at episodes 13 and 14 of The Office's fifth season, Prince Paper Company, and Stress Relief Part 1. They covered a myriad of topics, such as Mike facing an ethical dilemma, an amazing cold open, David Wallace as a perfect straight man, and the siblings heap a massive amount of praise of a certain episode. In the latest episode of Great Debate, host Andy Atherton is joined by Jacob Williams, Logan Carsling, Scott Shiflett, and Sean Kidd. The gang discusses and debates a variety of sports topics, including moves in play they would like to see more of in the NBA, MLB, NBA, and NHL, players they have a lot of respect for but hate the teams they play for. Whether or not an alternate league in sports other than football could work, and current athletes that could succeed in another sport, as well as pop culture topics such as which actor has the best
big screen Joker, as well as ranking the ones that have played the character. Jennifer Aniston versus Reese Witherspoon, songs that have been overplayed on movie soundtracks, TV shows that they loved when they first aired but realized they don't hold up, and what cultural events they'd like to attend one day. Also, be sure to check out the PTBN Wrestling feed, which includes a dive into topics running the gamut from the days WWE through yesteryear. The feed includes the Place to Be podcast, Main Event, Jenny and the Gems, Body Pressure Luck, PTB, NXT, and so much more. Subscribe today. And while you're at it, subscribe to Jennifer Smith's The Jenny Position feed as well, as it is the new home of Geek and Sassy, Talking Pop, Freak Out, Drive-In, Telling Stories, and more. Also, check out the new North-South Connection, brought to you by JT Rosero and Chad Campbell. It is the new home for Wrestling Warzone, No Holds Barred, The Extreme Three-Way Dance, Jeff Learns Wrestling, and more. And on our social media pages, the greatest sports logo of 2020 tournament is going on. There'll be 4 matches per day, so make sure you like our tournament page on Facebook or follow us on Twitter so you won't miss a single one. And we have kicked off our 2020 stretch project determining the greatest WCW match ever. You have all year to do research, promote message, and build your list. Conversation rules can be found at www.facebook.com/GWCW matches or on the Pro Wrestling Only message board. And be sure not to forget to check out placetobenation.com each and every day. We have new voices and fresh takes, bringing you articles on topics in the worlds of wrestling, sports, and pop culture, including Trent's SmackDown on Fox Report, This Week in the WWE by Jon Crow, Paulie's Perspective, Jason's DVD Deep Dive, and Ben's Unpopular Opinion. And don't forget to check out veteran columns like Glenn Butler's Wednesday Walk Around the Web. And if you're doing online shopping over at Amazon.com, be sure to click on the Amazon banner on the right side of the PTBN homepage or use www.placetobenation.com/Amazon. It takes you right to Amazon and helps out PTBN at no cost to you. All right, and let's get into our third and final topic of the day. And last month marked the 100th birthday of one of the legends in the television game show genre, Bill Cullen, and we will celebrate the occasion of his 100th birthday by looking at three of, well, his lesser-known shows. And those happen to be Winning Streak, The Love Experts, and Pass the Buck.
Episode 32, Submission 184, The Bill Cullen Centennial Tribute. We're going to look at three shows that Bill hosted over the years. Not necessarily great shows, but three shows he did nonetheless. But let's start off by talking about Bill. I think most of our listeners know who he is, but he's the dean of game shows. I'm plain and simple. You give him a show, even if it's a bad show like the three shows that we're going to talk about, he turns lemons into lemonade. Would you agree with that, gentlemen?
Yes.
Indeed.
And he's hosted so many shows over the years, so many good shows. The original Price is Right, and I Guess, and Three on a Match, and Child's Play, and Joker's Wild. Oh, and some show that that Gene Wood and Johnny Olsen were pitching this week on Match Game Hollywood Squares. Hot Potato!
Hot Potato!
Hot Potato!
From Hot Potato, Bill Cullen.
And he's right there. So now I learned, it's like, how do you incorporate Bill Cullen into a show that requires walking?
You go to the future by 15 or 20 years, get a Segway, and there you go.
Indeed. Yes, that's how you do it.
Right.
You get Begley's tortoise, and it does the rest.
That's exactly the answer I wanted to hear. You get Ed Begley's tortoise, go ahead to about 2003 or 2004, get the Segway, go back to 1984, and there's Bill Cullen maneuvering this demonic device. So the first show we're going to look at is Winning Streak. Winning Streak aired on NBC from July 1st of 1974 to January 3rd of 1975.
You
can double your money with every word, and you may win over $100,000, or you may go broke. The decision is yours. This is Winning Streak, starring Bill Cullen.
Hey, that's nice of you, Don. Thank you. Hi. Hello. Hello. And hi there.
So what was Winning Streak about besides another Bob Stewart, Bill Cullen collabo, an AC of Bob Stewart, Bill Cullen collabos?
I was hoping you'd call it a Bill Cullen and Bob Stewart joint, sort of like a Spike Lee film.
Joint is so 1991.
Well, collabo definitely isn't 1974, so I think we need to find a happy medium there. So what is Winning Streak? It's a mess. It really is. Yeah, you have a little bit of blockbusters, and you have it's almost like three games in one, sort of. So you have the blockbusters part. You're given a board of 16 letters, and you're given a topic. And what you need to do is, using those letters on the board only, and you can only use each letter once unless it's repeated on the board. So you could use, if there's like two O's or three O's, you can use three O's. But if there's only one L, you can't use more than that one L. And so you pick the letters blockbusters style, or not necessarily blockbuster style, but you pick letters, and Bill Cullen reads a question with an answer that starts with that letter. Not unlike blockbusters, which would come six and a half years later. So now the idea is, and here's where it gets a little convoluted and weird, is that if you get the question right, you can either not play the letter at all, or you've got a board in front of you using the little flippy letters you'd see at the airport. And I think there's seven spaces, and you need to ultimately win the game. You need to create a word with those letters. And I think it has to be at least like a three or four letter word. So you can't use like a two letter word. You can't weasel your way out. So I'm guessing the optimum strategy here would be find as short of a legal word as possible, because if you had some category like U.S. states, you know, okay, come up with the name of a U.S. state given these letters. You don't really want to go for Florida, because that's seven letters, when you could go with Iowa, which is four, nice and short. And so you'd only need realistically four correct answers to win the game, again, hypothetically, in a perfect scenario. So that's just the qualifier. That doesn't even win you anything except the right to play the next round. And now here's where, again, we add on the absurdity level. So you've got blockbusters, then you're using the letters that you earn in this blockbuster format to spell the answers, and then you play a totally different game. So what this game was it started with it looked very reminiscent of the Press Your Luck board, where you've got six squares on the top row, six squares on the bottom row, and then on the left and right sides, you have four squares each. So you have that same 18-square board like you have on Press Your Luck. So you get to pick one of the top six values.
And
there's six values there. They range from $100 to $200. And so what the idea is you pick one, and let's say you pick $150 or $160, and for every right answer that you give in this round, the money doubles, and then doubles and doubles and doubles. So hypothetically, if you got nine right answers, you could win or earn $100,000. Not necessarily win. We'll get to that in a second. And the way that you won each round is the remaining numbers, the 7 through 18, which would be 12 numbers, they had different letters of the alphabet. And so you call the letter, it's revealed, and you have to say a word that contains that letter. And the object is you don't want to repeat. So if you had the letter G first, you'd say go. Or you'd say egg. Or you'd generally go for a small word first, because obviously small words, they're not going to help you out when you get to 5 and 6 letters that you need to use. So, as I said, you don't win anything at this point, because now, first off, if you don't have a valid word, you lose. So you got to play it very strategically, but also at any time, you can stop. So if you're happy with, let's say, doubling your $150 three times, which would be 4 right answers, $150 for the first, then $300, $600, $1,200, then, okay, there's $1,200 in there, but now we need to go back and do the whole thing over again, where we go to that board and we play Blockbusters-ish, and then somebody has to spell a valid answer to whatever that category is, and then we repeat the cycle all over again with the second player, where pick a dollar amount, and then we'll go pick one of the 12 remaining squares for the letter, and again, play until you stop, or you ultimately get it wrong. And in that case, if you ever bombed out of the bonus game, your opponent automatically won. So I'm guessing it doesn't matter if it's the first person who plays or the second, which would really, well, you're sort of playing against the house if you're the second person. So that's not too bad. But obviously, if you lose there, you could have had your $1,200 in your pocket, but you decided to risk it. And then what happens is, if both people stop with their money, they go into a showdown. They play the same whole thing again, except you're not picking dollar amounts. You're just picking letters, and you're going back and forth. And the idea is whoever misses or gives an invalid word loses, and the person who survives wins both amounts of money. So that's why I said you can't. If you get the $100,000, you haven't won it yet until you beat your opponent in that other round. So the opponent could win the $100,000. Again, hypothetically. And this show is just so bland and boring and confusing. But also,
there's a rule in game show development, and I believe Mark Goodson's the one who first proposed it. If you can't describe it in one sentence, it's too complex. And this looks like you're going on in paragraphs.
Well, there's also a certain acronym, KISS. Keep it simple,
keep
stupid.
It simple. Keep it simple, dumbass. I mean, stupid.
Right. Well, but there's also one other little thing. You remember last week we talked about Beat the Clock back in 1979 and 80, and we added the celebrities, and we talked about the really major part of the gameplay that changed, that the money got cut.
Yeah.
Well, guess what? This was redone later in the show, and the money was cut. So instead of the double, 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 you just earned whatever you picked in that top row for each letter you added. So there goes the chance of $100,000, unless somehow there's 500 letters up there that you could play. It reeks of Bob Stewart being a little cheap, but also maybe, and again, we don't know if this ever happened, and we'll mention why in a moment. Maybe somebody took took Bob Stewart and NBC for $30,000, $40,000 on one game. You never know. I mean, it really depends what letters are on the board. You know, if you get like some INGED combination, something inged, that's probably not too hard to find, 8 letters that you can say, rehinged or something, or something inged or D blanking. I mean, it's all hypothetical, but yeah, there's had to be a reason that they cut the money, and I bet you it's because somebody took them for a good amount.
Yeah.
But we're talking about the show itself and, yeah, how, you know, there's a lot of conjecturing here. The main reason is because there is known to be one full episode which exists. There's a snippet of another episode, but there's one complete episode known to exist. And, Greg, you mentioned earlier, before we started, the story of that episode. Do you want to share that with everybody?
Yes, and this is from the website BillCullen.net, which is a fine website detailing the career of Mr. Cullen, and it's created by two people we know very well.
Yes, good friends of the podcast, Matt Ottinger and Adam Nediff. Thank you, guys. You guys are doing great work on your site, and please go visit them, BillCullen.net. Okay, Greg, what's the story about the single episode?
Okay, so the episode of Winning Streak That Survives is from August 9th of 1974, which would have been the day that Richard Nixon resigned. So Adam and Matt's theory is that the episode was originally preempted for news coverage and ended up in some different stack of tapes that survived when others were destroyed. So the most widely seen remnant of Winning Streak is an episode that pretty much did not air on the date it was supposed to air.
So, yeah, I mean, this series would be pretty much entirely wiped if it wasn't for Richard Nixon. So, thank your tricky dick wherever you are.
Thanks, I guess?
Well, at least we get to see it. I mean, that's, you know, hey, sort of a positive.
Hey, I'll let Dick know on his parody Twitter account.
Oh, jeez. Well, that was Winning Streak. Next up, we're going to talk about Bill, actually not really in a game show situation, even though it's sort of classified as a game show. He hosted a show back in 1978 called The Love Experts. The Love Experts aired in syndication, daily syndication, from September 18th of 1978 to September 7th of 1979.
For pretty Linda Kalina, night and day has become night or day. Kristen Gunderson is a tall blonde with a very interesting short story. And can you picture Muffy Durham in a see-through apron? They're all here to tell their stories to Joanne Worley, Jeff Edwards, Elaine Joyce, and Sufi Sales on The Love Experts, starring Bill Cullen.
Thank you all. Yay, well, what the heck. You've seen one, you've seen them all, I always say. Thank you, Jack, and thank you, and welcome to The Love Experts.
We mentioned that The Love Experts wasn't really a game show. It was like a talk show with the game show, but
it was a talk show that in the tradition of Cheap Cheap Cheap, it was a talk show that thought it was a game show, or it was a game show that thought it was a talk show. You have two people who brought in two people or two groups of people.
No. You had three.
Oh, three. My mistake. Three. You have a group of people who are competing to have who. The most outrageous true story of true love, and they brought it to a panel of love experts, which were nothing more than just celebrities who are making the rounds at the time.
Some of which included a young David Letterman, Elaine Joyce, Joanne Worley, Jeff Edwards, Jay Johnson, Billy Crystal, Anita Gillette, Soupy Sales, Jamie Lee Curtis, and Nipsey Russell.
Wow, what a group.
Yeah, and actually the episodes that are online, I think every one of them has David Letterman and Jeff Edwards, and I think possibly they also have Elaine Joyce and Joanne Worley. Going through the list of names I mentioned earlier, I don't remember seeing Anita Gillette. I don't remember seeing Nipsey Russell, Jamie Lee Curtis, Jay Johnson, any of those folks.
Okay, so, hold on. I'm going to stop you right there. Because Rhonda Shear, who's actually on an episode of The Love Experts, posted her segment on her YouTube account. Which is, by the way, still a really good YouTube account. And one of the panelists, I believe David Letterman, was on that same panel, but so was Jamie Lee Curtis.
Well, I was talking about the full episodes. I know her snippet, her segment is in there, and she actually talks about that. But in terms of full episodes, I do believe that David Letterman, Elaine Joyce, Joanne Worley, Jeff Edwards are the celebrities on the shows that are online. And also, I'll take partial blame for this because these are shows that I originally purchased back off. They're originally shows I purchased off of eBay back around like 2000, 2001. So you're welcome, America.
You're responsible for that.
I'm responsible for everything. I'm responsible for Love Experts. I'm responsible for Malcolm, future installment, by the way. I'm responsible for everything. Just place all your blame right at my shoulders.
Yeah, I've been blaming you for almost 20 years about Malcolm.
And I'm sure you're going to have a good time when we talk about it soon.
Yeah, it's going to be a good time, all right.
Yeah, well, for somebody, I think. So you'd have three guests appear and talk about their love lives, and they were odd situations. I can only imagine some of the stories there'd be nowadays, since people are a little more free and open with their, you know, different type of relationship statuses and fetishes and stuff like that. But it was typical, like, 70s fare in terms of, you know, swapping partners, or I have a male roommate and also I live with my sister. So me and my sister are fighting over the roommate or something like that. And the celebrity panel would choose which of these three guests had the most interesting story, and they would win a prize. So it's not unlike, let's say, Queen for a Day, maybe, where not necessarily the best sob story one, but just overall the most interesting or the best story one. Before the big winner of the day was revealed, there would be a Q&A session with the audience where Bill sort of moderated it, and the audience would actually ask the celebrities or Bill himself for advice regarding relationships.
Yeah,
it's not particularly interesting or fun, but it's definitely something.
Yeah.
Yep. It was definitely a thing on TV. That's for sure.
It was. And you know what else was a thing on TV?
What the else last, was a thing on TV?
The last entry of the day.
Oh, boy. Yes. Here we go.
Yep, here we go. Pass the Buck. Pass the Buck aired on CBS from April 3rd of 1978 to June 30th of 1978 for 62 episodes.
Ladies and gentlemen, these four players are about to make instant decisions under pressure. Only the last survivor will win the game and all the money on Pass the Buck with your host, Bill Cullen.
And really, I, even though this show lasted 62 episodes, I really think, honestly, this is like Bill's most underrated show. I think he really enjoyed this. He was very funny in it, very quick with the one-liners. So what Pass the Buck is a variant of Pyramid, kind of, sort of. And what we mean by that, you have four contestants, and by doing this three times, you're going to get down to one contestant who goes to the bonus game. And what happens is Bill Cullen gives a topic, and you have to give an answer that fills the criteria of that topic. Now, it isn't necessarily as simple as name a fruit or name a state capital. Oh, no. It might be something like, and this is actually one that was used on the show, you had to make a four-letter sentence. The first word had to be somebody's name, and the fourth word had to rhyme with that person's name. So for example, and this is one that was on the show, Dick has a stick. So what happens is that the bank starts out at $100, and every valid answer gets $25 added to that bank. And play goes down the line, down a row, and then once they get to the end of the row, it repeats back to the beginning of the row, and lather, rinse, repeat, until you get a wrong answer, or an answer that isn't acceptable. Then the next person in line has to give an acceptable answer to add $25 more to the bank, but also knock out the person that got the wrong answer. And then that losing contestant goes to a bullpen, but isn't out of the game. We'll get to that a little bit later. So the game repeats with three players. New category, give right answers until you get an incorrect or unacceptable answer. The next person in line can knock you out. So you're down to two people. Again, $25 for each answer added to the existing bank. And then you repeat that again with the two people, going back and forth until one of them gives an unacceptable answer. If the remaining contestant can give a correct answer, they win, again, another $25 in the bank. But they win the entire bank, and that generally could be anywhere from about $600 or $700 up to about $1,000, $1,100, depending on the difficulty of the questions. But also, if you're in a situation where the person before you gave an incorrect answer, if you give an incorrect answer, you're in jeopardy too. So it's possible, and it did happen on the show a few times, where two people got knocked out by a third person giving a correct answer. So if you can't give a correct answer yourself, you're in jeopardy, you're at risk, and you'll be off to the bullpen. Or same thing, I would assume would happen if three people got a wrong answer, one person gets it right, they win everything. But if all four people, I don't know what would happen there if all four got it correct. They'd probably all stay in and just play it over again, or it would be edited out. This show was...
It was complex.
It wasn't complex. Actually, I was going to talk about the humor factor.
It was very funny.
This show was very funny, and actually, again, we're going to talk about BillCullen.net. We're going to talk about our buddy Adam and our buddy Matt. There is an over 26-minute video of highlights from Pass the Buck, including numerous episodes which haven't been seen since 1978, because Game Show Network did air it for a brief while on weekends back in 1997 and I think 1998. And I think they got maybe about 25 episodes in, 24 episodes in. So there were still a good almost three dozen or so episodes that hadn't aired. And I personally know that one of the episodes that didn't air that is on this highlight package is from the final episode of Pass the Buck, from episode 62. So definitely go take a look at that highlight video. It'll have you laughing. But now we haven't even gotten to the bonus round. The one survivor of bonus round, this is sort of like your reverse pyramid, where you're given the category and you need to give answers that fit that category. The bonus game is played on a board that looks like a right triangle with four boxes on the bottom row, three on the second row, two on the third row, and one on top. And the idea was behind those boxes are different answers which fit this category. If you can either clear all the answers in a row, regardless of the row, whether it's the first, second, third, or fourth, or if you can get one answer from every level correct, you win $5,000. And if you get none of the answers right, game is over, but you win $100 for each box you uncovered. But also at the same time, the people that are in the bullpen go back into the game. So we start again with the same four players. If you win the bonus, the $5,000, you stay on the show. The three people who lost out in that preliminary round, they leave the show. And there seemed to be times that people would be on this show for close to a week, maybe even longer. maybe they played six or seven games, because you would see contestants, and I believe this is on the highlight package that I mentioned earlier, where you would have contestants where your champion might have won like $8,000 or $12,000, and each of the other three contestants who's not the champion has won something, whether it's like $600 or $1,500. The money got spread around pretty well around here. As long as, you know, somebody didn't win the bonus round, because if you kept on coming back, your odds of making more money sort of went up. So you wouldn't leave empty-handed necessarily. So, yeah, so the idea is in the Fast Bucks, the bonus round, the four levels has four answers. There's generally like three really simple answers, and then there's one that's obscure. Same thing with the third level, except there's two really easy answers and one obscure one. There's always one obscure one. Same on the second level, one easy, one obscure, and the top answer, that is a toughie.
Divine toughie.
Well, do you want to win $5,000? They're not going to just hand it to you.
Okay.
Yeah, fair enough.
Mm-hmm.
Also of note, this was Bill Cullen's last show in New York.
Yes.
Yeah.
And notable, where was Pass the Buck taped?
It was taped in the Ed Sullivan Theater.
Oh,
that's right. The future home of The Late Show with David Letterman and The Late Show with Stephen Colbert.
And you could sort of see the staging there. You can imagine Letterman, where Letterman would be sitting, where Paul Schaefer and the band would be sitting. You can sort of visualize that when you see that studio and just, again, how big it is. But also when you look at the audience, when they show audience shots, you almost have to say to yourself, oh my gosh, that's the exact type of seating that the Letterman show used and Colbert. And it had the same exits, same locations. I mean, I know they did vast updates before Letterman started recording there back in 93, but you could still see, you know, watching these shows, the exits are in the same places, obviously, but it's almost like Letterman didn't change much, even though, yeah, I remember the footage from back in the day where they took out all the old seats, put in the new seats, and refurbished the Ed Sullivan Theater for the Letterman show, but you can sort of picture where everything was with Letterman when you're watching Pass the Buck.
Yeah,
but this was one of the last shows of a dying breed, game shows in New York, which we'll sort of cover in our next topic.
Yeah, we will, but we'll talk about that in a second. Oh, Chico, would you like to sign us off?
Okay, so not everything Bill Cullen touched turns to gold, although he did try and make it work as best he could. Shows like Jokers, Blockbusters, Hot Potato, those were all gems. But if you want to talk about winning streak and Pass the Buck, you know what you'd be talking about?
They were things on TV.
Just things on TV.
And the Love Experts, too.
And the Love Experts, that was a thing on TV, too.
We could have done other shows, but we specifically chose these three shows in this quasi-tribute to Bill Cullen's 100th birthday coming up on this coming Tuesday, the 18th of February. Again, I want to give huge thanks to Adam Nediff and to Matt Ottinger. They have the definitive Bill Cullen page, and they're constantly adding stuff. I know that recently Adam acquired some videotapes from the collection of Bill Cullen himself, and he's gotten photos and other items from, not necessarily, well, we'll say the estate of Bill Cullen. It's more the estate of Jack Nars, but again, if in case you don't know, Jack Nars and Tom Kennedy, for that matter, were brothers-in-law of Bill Cullen. So we're keeping it in the family, if you will. So yeah, definitely, they're always adding really good stuff there. They're always posting really cool finds on their Facebook page. Again, go visit them. They are at BillCullen.net.
BillCullen.net. And tell them that the folks at It Was a Thing on TV sent you.
It won't get you anywhere, but you can tell them that we sent you over there.
And also, if you go to the Past the Buck page, there's a really cool shot of the Ed Sullivan Theater marquee with Past the Buck on the marquee.
We just love the David Letterman show.
Really?
No, that's another entry, but not that.
That is another entry.
We love the Late Show with David Letterman era, especially Pat and Kenny read all the transcripts. But that'll be on another show.
and we like Late Night with David Letterman, and specifically, we like Father Biff.
Oh yes,
hey, Biff.
But that's another show for another time.
Okay, well, before we go out to Rupert's Hello Deli and get some pastrami, we just want to plug the website, itwasathingontv.com. There you'll find all of our social media feeds, past episodes, and, of course, links to where all fine podcasts can be streamed, because you will find It Was a Thing on TV there as well, including, Spotify, Stitcher, Podbean, of course, and of course, our good friends at The Place to Be Nation.
Yeah, that's right. There's all of our back catalogs coming up slowly every Wednesday. The latest drop on Wednesday was, this past Wednesday was, Flying High, the Star Wars Holiday Special, and guess what? Mystery Diners.
Okay, so they're up to Christmas, so they're less than 2 months away. Okay,
yeah.
Good.
Yeah, we're slowly getting there.
We'll be there by, hopefully, before summer, so good.
Yeah, and it helps we'll have that break, too.
Indeed. Yeah. Well, guys, you guys are going to go to the Hello Deli. I'm going to Rock America to see Muji Burr and Sarah Jewell. See you next time.
With another thing on TV.
Wow!
Dick has a stick.
Ha 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 ha!